Star Wars The Empire Strikes Back Collection. Millennium Falcon that you put together. Batteries not included.
Nice landing, Han Solo. Uh-oh, come on, Chewbacca. Stormtroopers are coming.
Action figures each sold separately.
Got them on radar. I'll fire the laser cannon.
There's even a hidden storage hatch.
Ready for takeoff. Jump to light speed. We're gone. On to the Death Star.
Millennium Falcon from Kenner's Star Wars The Empire Strikes Back Collection. Action figures each sold separately.
Hey.
What's happening?
Not too much. Just Fat Albert in here.
Yeah. Didn't Rerun used to say something like that, or Dwayne from What's Happening? What did they used to say?
Oh, maybe.
I don't know.
You have to get Steve back on to ask him that.
Yeah.
You're going back before
you
my
didn't,
time.
You didn't watch What's Happening?
No. Nope. I know of it, but yeah. It's, I think that...
You at least know Rerun. It's pretty iconic, right? The Suspenders.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm aware of it and stuff.
Right on.
So this is episode 8, I think?
Yeah.
Of the Geek Brunch Retrocast. My name is Mantra.
Ah.
I'm a man trapped in a lady's body.
Yeah, you read some Malibu comics.
Yeah.
I am Dazzler.
Oh, we're
and I can skate. Yeah, I can skate like nobody's business.
Skate and dance and sing and
sing and light up the stage.
And you're
presence.
A cheap act to bring in because you pack your own pyrotechnics. You're your own light show. You know, it's funny that you mentioned Dazzler because it's been I think it's been 3 weeks since we last recorded.
Yeah.
Instead of normal two, and in that time I read Marvel Comics The Untold Story, because my mom got a Kindle Fire, so she gave me her old Kindle, so I was looking to try it out and see if I liked reading on it, and so I got that for the Kindle and read it. It was pretty good. I read it pretty quickly. It's pretty interesting. Just kind of goes through the whole history of Marvel Comics from the very beginning and catches you up. There's a lot of detail about the Image era and like the bankruptcy and stuff like that after. And then it does go to the present day, but the last few years it kind of just ends with Disney buying the Marvel and a brief mention of how much money like the Avengers made and stuff. But anyways, yeah, it's kind of amusing to read about the creation of Dazzler and how, as you might guess, it really was, an attempt to make a Disco character. And by the time they got the character out, Disco was already
already gone, yeah.
Waning in popularity, yeah. So they kind of did what they could do with it. I think they were even trying to get record labels or something interested in the character and trying to create some kind of crossover or something, but yeah, it's interesting.
So is that like a lot of prose, or is it kind of like the DC ones where there's a lot of pictures with the verbiage?
It's a lot of prose. I don't know if in the print copy there's any pictures. I know the author has a Tumblr site where he has a lot of pictures that are intended to go. You know, like you often see in a print biography or something like that, in the center of the book, they'll have the glossy pages with photographs from like the subject's life and stuff. He kind of has that, but on a Tumblr site. So I don't know if it wasn't in the Kindle copy. I don't know if it's reproduced in the.
Yeah. I follow them on Facebook and I know he posts a lot of cool pictures. I just didn't know if those pictures were in the book.
Not in the Kindle copy, so I'm not really sure, but. It's mostly a prose story, but yeah, I found it really interesting. There's a lot. since, you know, we talk about Kirby regularly, there's a lot about Kirby in there, and of course, and but I really wanted to dig some more into that, so I haven't been going through it as quickly, but after I finished that, I picked up, it's called Tales to Astonish. It's a little bit older, but it's specifically about Stan Lee and Jack Kirby.
Oh, I read that one.
Yeah, I thought you might, because there's been some facts and different details that I sounded familiar from you mentioning them, so I thought you might have read it.
Yeah, I read that. I don't read a lot of prose, as you might guess, but right. I did read that, and I did read the Stan Lee autobiography.
Oh, okay.
So those are two that I read.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. I definitely am getting... I kind of have like a man crush on Jack Kirby right now, because he's such an interesting character himself.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes people who create comics, you know, they're just... their own lives are pretty normal and stuff like that, but maybe it was just the era and... the fact that you have war service involved there and everything, but one of the anecdotes I know that you've mentioned before that I came across in the book is where he was working for I think it was Will Eisner, and the gangster showed up trying to get like protection money.
Yeah, I read that.
And eventually Kirby walks down like, "What the hell's going on around here?"
He's gonna kick some ass, because that's why it reminds me of Scrapper. I think Kirby had the guns and stuff to just kick somebody's ass if he had to.
Definitely. I think the way that the author describes it is he kind of stood up to the guy, and the guy took his measure and could tell that Kirby had, you know, grown up in a rough neighborhood and had been in gangs, and you can kind of get that sense from somebody that they're not afraid, you know?
Yeah, he grew up in the streets.
Yeah. And so, yeah, he definitely had that presence, and he told Eisner, "If anybody like that comes around again, just call me." So it's pretty cool.
So you were in the prose mode, like learning a lot.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I've been bringing it to work and reading it on my lunch break and stuff like that, you know, and I'm only a little bit into Tales to Astonish, kind of slowed down, but I read, Marvel comic, The Untold Story, pretty quickly.
How many pages is that?
Off the top of my head, I want to say it's probably between 200 and 300.
Ah.
Something like that. But it's hard to tell. Reading on the Kindle, you can change the font size and whatnot, so it's you see a percentage tracker along the bottom.
Yeah.
Instead of a page number, so you're not on page such and such, you're like 35% complete or something.
Depending on how you zoomed in or what.
Yeah, I think if you, the more you zoom in, probably the each time you click to the next quote-unquote page, if you're zoomed in a lot, you'd be jumping the percentage up more than you would if it was pretty large print. So yeah, I've been doing some prose reading, but comic book related prose reading.
Yeah. So I thought we'd open up with the loose comics, since we last episode we talked a lot about Jack Kirby. And
yeah, only kind of.
Although you can't like read stuff like, I actually made an attempt this time to try to read a non-Kirby stuff. So yeah, I'll talk about this one first. This one is Marvel Feature Presents The Astonishing Ant-Man. I think it was from 1972. Let me see. 1972. And I've always liked Ant-Man, more so than, you know, I'm a DC guy by heart, but I've always found Ant-Man more interesting than like Ray Palmer, Adam.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always liked what was going on with this. Well, this actually, I said, oh, it's not going to be a Jack Kirby issue, because, you know, I remember him starting it in Tales to Astonish, but It turns out this was part reprint, so it had Stanley and Jack Kirby. So the story was by Mike Frendrick, which I mostly know from DC, with art by Craig Russell and Jim Starlin. And it had the flashback sequence by Stanley and Jack Kirby. And what was really cool is the Wasp is trying to kill him, so he has a flashback of the origin of the Wasp. So it actually goes back to Tales to Astonish number 44, which was the origin of the Wasp, how she came into his life. And it was cool revisiting of his origin, too, because he had a weird... He married this wife from Hungary, and her father was a scientist as well, and he was all in love with her, and she wanted to go back to Hungary, and she was wanted for leaving it, you know, like for... But she said, nobody will recognize me, and now that I'm an American citizen, nobody will recognize me. Well, as soon as they get there, they capture her, and they kill her. So that's how he becomes the Ant-Man, because he wants revenge. Not only do they kill her, but while they're away, back in the States, they kill her father. You know, they blow up the lab, and the father dies. So that's how he becomes Ant-Man. He wants revenge. So that's, you know, that's the origin of him. And then it cuts to the origin of the Wasp, and Janet's father was also a scientist, and he wanted Hank Pym's help with he was creating like communication links between us and alien races, and he wanted Hank Pym to help him, and Hank Pym didn't want none of that because that wasn't his specialty. He didn't want anything to do with gamma rays because they were working with gamma rays. And he beamed down this weird alien creature who's going to destroy the Earth. It was actually a prisoner on the world of Cosmos. And it turns out the father, just by looking at him, you can't even look at this creature. You'd end up dying of fear. And the father ends up dying, so Janet seeks out Hank Pym's help. And Hank Pym is looking for like a sidekick because he thinks he's going to die or something and he needs to carry on the Ant-Man legacy. Well, Wasp becomes that, and she falls in love with him, and all he could keep mentioning is how young Janet is. Like, she's too young for me. Like, she must be like, I don't know, 18 or 16, I don't know. And and he's already like 25 or something like that, and she falls in love with him, and he's starting to fall in love with her, and they end up defeating the creature using he has ants carry a gun all the way. Like, I don't know how fast ants can carry it from his house to downtown Manhattan, but they seem to manage to get this shotgun over there, and they shoot this weird chemical into him and destroy the alien creature. But it is really cool. It was a really cool story. I was glad to revisit his origin because I've always enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's probably not an aspect of gun control that the government's not considering, you know.
Yeah.
The ability of ants to carry shotguns around. Downtown Manhattan.
Yeah, he used to have this like thing called a catapult or whatever, which looked like a gun thing that would just shoot him from his house into wherever he needed to go because he was always in ant form. The one thing I could never figure out, though, is he designed Wasp costume to be a lot better. Like, she had the Wasp stings and the wings so she could fly, but he couldn't. You know, he'd go riding the ants. Wouldn't he want to fly too?
That's a good question. I don't think he ever really could make up his mind what he wanted to do as a superhero, though, right?
Yeah. Well, he's Yellow Jacket, Giant Man. I mean, he's had all those personas, and This issue did mention how, like, even the flashback by Kirby and Lee, it did mention that he didn't really ever care about, like, being a hero. I mean, he wanted to avenge things and be a hero, but he also didn't want to lose his science. Like, that was number one for him. Like, in one issue, he's, like, reading, he's, like, listening to the police band, and the police are chasing criminals, and he, like, just sits back and says, well, it looks like the police have it under control, so he goes back to his experiment. So, yeah. You know, that's his nature.
Yeah, I feel like that was addressed in something I read more recently, too. I don't know if it was new Marvel stuff I was reading or something, but it was kind of the same sense that science was the number one thing for him, and not his focus wasn't being a superhero as much as it was on working on his experiments and his science and stuff.
Yeah.
It's consistency of character there, but that's funny that going back, it's with the Ant-Man movie being worked on, it's like Stan Lee's dream coming true, because that was another thing that I learned was that once, for some reason, Ant-Man's always been a Stan Lee favorite, and was when he was, he's been trying to get Marvel movies made since the 70s, it seems like, and once he moved out to Hollywood and was living out there, and it was always a focus for him to try to get an Ant-Man movie made for some reason. So he's got to be like, it's cool that he most likely is going to live to see it finally on the big screen for him.
Yeah.
It should be a good movie considering it's the Shaun of the Dead guy that's doing it.
I hope so. I haven't heard much about it other than it was being made, but I haven't seen any like stills or anything about it.
No, because I think it's still a little, we got several films to come, but I'm pretty sure it's a definite thing. It's definitely happening. But yeah, that's cool. Now, is Wasp, is she alive again yet?
Yes, I think.
Current continuity?
Yeah.
That happened recently, right? I know she was dead.
Yeah, she was dead. And then she came back because it turns out that I think she shrunk herself or something. She was like with the aliens for a while, but she was like microscopic size. Like that happened in like New Avengers or something where they brought her, where she came back. She was like in the microverse is where she was.
Oh, okay.
Somewhere like that where everybody was small and she couldn't escape, but she managed to trigger off her Avengers card, while she was there. And that's how the Avengers went into that microverse and grabbed her and got her out.
That'd be cool if she came back with a bunch of the Micronauts or something, and she's like the new leader of the Micronauts.
Yeah.
Got like Bug, and I think Bug's the only one they have the rights to, though, because he was an original creation.
Yeah.
Cool. So you tried to get away from Kirby and you can't.
Well, no, I haven't. I've been also reading Devil Dinosaur, and that one, I will say, it's like visually stunning. Like the artwork is even sometimes better than what we're seeing. Mm-hmm. But story wise, it's very one dimensional, I would say.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like Moon Boy befriending or helping this dinosaur since it was like a pup, and then becoming friends, and then the dinosaur scaring away all his people, even though he was a protector of the people. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and then these like different factions want to capture Devil Dinosaur, but I'm reading that in an omnibus because Marvel did release a Devil Dinosaur omnibus, and I did recently complete my singles too, so I have a full run now of Devil Dinosaur.
Oh, cool. And that was one of the things Kirby did for Marvel when he went back after the Fourth World stuff we're reading, right?
Yeah, and I heard somewhere, I can't remember if it was in that book that you're reading now or... It was in something I read that at the time they were trying to make a Devil Dinosaur like a big thing so they could make it animated.
Okay. That's interesting because Kirby, he ended up doing a lot of animation stuff after he left Marvel.
Yeah. One of my favorites, Thundar.
Yeah. Did you? I keep forgetting to mention this, but I think I have him right here. Have you ever seen the stuff? It's actually like a little set of trading cards of stuff that of like art and things like that that Kirby did for animation.
No, I haven't. Are they like
company here?
Like Tops or something? Put them out or what?
Ruby Spears.
Ah.
So it's It's called Jack Kirby, The Unpublished Archives.
Uh-huh.
And they came out in 94 from Ruby Spears, and it's all stuff that some of it was used, but most of it was stuff that never got used. It's a, let me see, it's an, I think a 90-card set.
Wow.
I found out about it. You should eBay and see if you can get, because I know I got them off of eBay, and I think I got them for only like between 10 and 15 bucks. But
what is the title of the cars? Ruby Spears or what?
Ruby Spears made it. You can try that, but they're called Jack Kirby, The Unpublished Archives. And they're 90 cards, and they just, each one has like a little bit of Kirby art on the front. They're like glossy cards. In the back, it tells you a little bit about the stuff. But some of them are pretty cool, and it's interesting. Like, the way that he could invent ideas and stuff like that. I mean, there's different teams that he made up that, and different characters and stuff. Like, I'm just looking through randomly here. This one has, like, a female superheroine called Tempest. And there's, on the front, it's got just a bunch of different shots. Like, there's, like, a headshot, full body shot. There's a little part where she's fighting a robot. And I think they took several sketches and combined them. And on the back, it tells you just some different things about... It's just a few sentences on the back about, you know, the character.
That sounds pretty cool. I'll have to look that up. I didn't know it existed before you mentioned it.
Yeah, I forgot how I found out about it. I think maybe I was just reading about, like... I was curious about what Kirby had done after he... Like, in his, like, later years... I knew, you know, they had done some independent comic work, you know, for Pacific Comics and things like that, but he did a lot of work for animation, and I think Ruby Spears just basically brought him in as like a one-man idea farm, and he was just, I mean, most of the stuff was not ever used, these concepts, but, you know, he just was churning out ideas and characters and things like that for them to use. So, yeah, you should definitely, I'm sure you'll be fascinated by it.
Yeah, I'll have to Google that later. I mean, eBay it, see if I can find them.
Yeah, if you get a copy, we could talk about them later on. We can, like, pick out some favorites or something.
Sure.
So, I did mention I read some Ultraverse Malibu comics, but I'll create suspense and not talk about those yet. Because the one thing that I did read that wasn't Malibu, I'm still, you know, and I will be for a while checking out first couple of issues of all these like 80s independent comics that I got. I actually read these back before our last podcast and didn't get a chance to talk about them, but I read the first two issues of John Sable Freelance from First Comics.
Ah, that's one of my favorite.
I thought it might be because I know you really like Mike Grell, and that's the creator of this. He pretty much did everything on these issues but color them. And the colorist was a woman named Janice Cohen. So like I said, these are from First Comics, and they came out in June, July of 83. Not only did Mike Grell do these by himself, they're also 28 pages, so it's pretty impressive. And John Sable, basically, he's a kind of a vigilante. Well, he definitely is a vigilante. The first issue is called The Iron Monster, and we're introduced to the fact that he's got a... so that was pretty interesting. Like, he's got an alter ego, and he actually uses disguise elements. A lot of times the alter ego is just, you know, the superhero wears a mask, sometimes not even, I mean, it's just like a little domino mask like Robin or something, where you really have to have some suspension of disbelief to accept that people don't recognize them, I think. And, but in this case, you know, John Sable, he fights crime pretty much, he's got this magical or I guess kind of magical, but he's got this mask that he uses, but it doesn't cover his features, so he basically fights crime with his regular face. So his alter ego is B.B. Phlegm, and who's a children's author who's got published books and everything like that, and he wears a blonde wig and a mustache.
Yeah, I remember those recently because I read the IDW. They recently put out a new series, and he still had that alias.
It's pretty awesome because he's like, it's pretty subversive.
Yeah, Groucho Marx glasses.
Yeah, and he's and the fact that he's, you know, he's a vigilante, and this vigilante is writing and publishing really popular children's books, you know.
Yeah.
But when we're introduced to him, we're the police are pretty pissed off of him at him because before the comic starts, Sable's captured a child killer. So the public's really in support of this, of him as a vigilante, and the police are upset because you know, they want, you know, because he's, what he's doing is against the law, and they want the public support for the police department and stuff. And President, this isn't the first time an actual president will appear in the stuff that I read for this time, but President Reagan, he's not named, but it's made very clear that that's who it is. He actually hires John Sable to protect him from an assassination attempt. And the Iron Monster from the title, it's like this, I kind of had to figure it out, but essentially it's a what they call a machine rest, so for a rifle, and the assassin is using one. It's a guy named Milo Jackson, and he's using it basically so that he can steady his rifle and fire a really heavy round a long distance away. So that's the, like, kind of like the main plot. It's kind of, you know, it's wrapped up by the end, but there's a connection to the overall story for John Sable, is that he knows this Milo Jackson. He knows him from their past, and we get a little bit more into that in the second issue, which is called Death is a Bum Deal. And speaking of his alter ego, we kind of got like a cool sequence in the beginning where he finally meets his illustrator. So, you know, they're picture books that he creates about this. I think it's like a leprechaun or something like that.
Yeah, on the cover of it. It's like a Lucky Charms guy.
Yeah. So he had some kind of like issues or complaints about the art, and he has a meeting with the artist and his editor, and it's the first time he ever met his artist, whose name is Mike Blackman. But he finds out that Mike is M-Y-K-E, and it's actually a woman. So he's caught off guard because she's an attractive lady, and he's not prepared for that. So he kind of just like trashes her and gets out of there real quick. And she's pretty defensive of her art, not willing to just be dismissed. And she had, you know, made plans to go out of her way for this meeting and everything like that. She follows him and discovers his real identity. she watches B.B. Phlegm go to this building, and then she goes up, and John Sable answers the door, and he can't get rid of her. So she's kind of interesting supporting cast that's introduced. But the main plot here is he's hired by this woman who basically somebody's killing homeless people. And this woman, her father actually was like a pretty important person before he became homeless. And she thinks that there's more to it than just, the police think that that's a gang initiation thing where they you know, to be in the gang, you got to go kill a homeless person. But this guy's daughter, she thinks there's more to it, and he finds out that John Sable ends up finding out that there's not like different bullets. There's different bullets at each like homeless person's killing the crime scene. And so because of that, that's why the police think it's gangs. But Sable ends up finding out that there's like different bullets being used by the same person. And it turns out to be like a secret code. Like these bullets are left behind at the scene of the crime with muzzle marks on them. They're actually like a secret code to transmit secret messages between old Nazi party members, like, you know, German members that are retired in the United States. So it's pretty crazy. But yeah, the Mike Grell art is really great. You know, it's an interesting character, and it's I mentioned that he knows that Milo Jackson guy, and basically there's a backstory there that John Sable and this Milo Jackson, they were in mercenaries together, and also were sharpshooters, like marksmen in the Olympics and stuff. And there's a whole backstory that issues after this get into about his past before the comic starts and stuff. So it's really I'm gonna pick up some more issues of this. I was pretty impressed and really liked them.
Yeah, I've always liked those. That's something I want to reread. I remember the first issue as you were describing it, but I don't remember too much of the second issue.
It holds up, you know.
Yeah, it's really good.
I mean,
he drew that Mike woman really beautiful. Didn't she have like reddish brown hair or something?
Yeah, she has like short hair.
Yeah.
Mike Grell can draw some like really classic pinup style looking.
Oh, yeah.
In the first issue, his editor is also attractive.
I'm thinking of his editor, I think.
Maybe, because in the first issue,
She has really long hair, right?
She has long hair, yeah.
Yeah.
In the first issue, he calls her, talking to her on the phone, and there's a implication that they've had some romantic involvement. She sort of invites him over, and he's like, he's got to do something as John Sable, so he has to turn her down, but... You know, you see her laying there in her like negligee and stuff as she's talking to him. It's like, you're lost, man.
Yeah, he draws women like nobody's business, and he really does it in The Warlord because they have a lot more skimpy outfits.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would like to check those out someday. I'm pretty new to Mike Grell. I've read The Longbow Hunters. And if you're listening and you've read that, and you would like this too, I think. The tone is pretty similar. But I haven't read a lot of Mike Grell, and I'm definitely going to change that.
Yeah, I have an original of his that I got at a con. Plus, I went to his he had a a con panel, you know, like the life of Mike Grell or something like that. Mm. And it was really fascinating because I don't remember exactly where he was, but he was, I don't know if it was in John Sable or something. I can't remember the comic now, but where he had an outing with white supremacists. Well, he lived in an area where white supremacy was really big. And I guess the white supremacist guy got a hold of, the information, you know, what he was making them look bad in the comic books. Right.
Mm.
So one night, really late, like I guess he lived like on the top of a towards the top of a hill or something like that, and it was snowing really, really bad, and he saw a truck coming like to his house, and he looked in the back of the truck, and there was like a bunch of dudes with guns, like they were coming to his house. And Mike Grell had weapons of himself. So he pulled out a gun and just aimed it right at the truck, and I guess those guys saw it. Like, he was, like, going to snipe them off the truck.
Uh-huh.
And they turned around.
Dang.
And they left him alone. But he said that his dog would always, you know, alert him if something weird was happening.
Mm. Yeah, that was something I did come across, the fact that he's into, you know, guns and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's where kind of You definitely would have to be or have done some research to include some of the detail, you know, that's in the first issue of John Sable with the machine rest thing that the assassin is using and stuff. But I mean, that's not an interest of mine. But I think he's a real good storyteller. And
oh, he's fantastic. His art style is awesome.
Yeah, I there's an ad in the back of one of them for Star Slayer, which I guess he was doing at the same time.
Yeah.
Which looks really cool, too.
I don't know if you know this, but they had a John Sable TV series. I don't know if it was just a pilot, but...
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
I don't know if we'd ever be able to find it, but...
Yeah.
I didn't know about it until I went to the panel, too. It's like, he said that Gene Simmons was really interested in John Sable.
Oh, my gosh. I can't see that, but I can see a TV show based on this, definitely.
That's a good comic. That's something I want to revisit. So I have a Mike Grell Warlord that he drew for me, and I'm so glad. Even though it was expensive, the fact that I have a Mike Grell is like, it means a lot, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like some of these artists, I really want to get sketches from, even if I do pay that much, because... Man, they just meant so much to me as a kid that, you know, to have an original piece is amazing.
Yeah, well, it's when the price is worth it, or when you know it's not gonna, you know, it's one thing if you're buying something from an artist that's like, you know, hot at the moment, but you don't know if they're gonna last. It's another thing if you're buying something from like somebody that's proven to be a part of comic book history, you know that's not gonna lose value, you know.
Right. So, yeah, that was I want to go read some John Sable now. This podcast is killing me. I don't want to read the new stuff anymore. But I have another couple of books, and I might as well jump into the one that this came from a hardcover I bought. It's called Avengers: The Coming of the Beast. So what it is it's comics with the Beast in it, like how he became an Avenger. You know, it went from the X-Men to the Avengers. It was written by Steve Englehart, art by George Tuska, and guess who was the inker?
Mike Grell?
No. Vince Coletta.
Vince Coletta. That's what I was just trying to think of.
The guy does everything. But this is Avengers 137. And it opens up with the weird scene. This guy comes home from work and his wife is like, hard day at the office. And he says, yeah, I just want to come in and get a martini and watch some Hogan's Heroes. I love cable. And he turns on the TV and then it's got Thor yelling at him. He's like, we're recruiting heroes. We do seek out new Avengers. So he's like putting a public announcement out, because I guess a few of the Avengers, this is the time that the Vision fell in love with Wanda and they're separating, and a couple other Avengers, they're off, like Mantis was one of those Avengers and she's leaving. So they're looking to grow their team. And they recruited Moondragon. She's the first one that they recruited, you know, the bald character with the green costume. I don't know much about her. I like read her in the Defenders, and I don't know a lot about her or what her power base is, so I'll have to. But this issue is like one of those fun issues, which I've always enjoyed as a kid, where they're trying to recruit new members, you know, who's going to be an Avenger, and you're excited to find out. Well, they call a lot of people and get rejected. They call Black Panther and he's like, I'm too busy. And Wakanda, and they call Quicksilver, and he's pissed that his sister's marrying an android. So he's like, he's mad enough, and they call Black Widow, and she says she's busy with Daredevil, and they call Cap, and he's busy tracking down the Red Skull, and they call Hercules, and he's enjoying himself and doesn't want to go into adventure, and so they're not having very much luck. And Hawkeye he's a member now too. It's Hawkeye, Thor, and Iron Man, and Hawkeye doesn't want them to recruit. He doesn't think they need anybody, but they call Janet, and the Wasp wants to come back because she says that Yellowjacket was with the Defenders, and you know, they were supposed to be on like a sabbatical to be with each other, but I guess Hank, you know, being Hank, left to go have an adventure with the Defenders, and she left a message with them. So they both actually joined back up. And it's funny that we just talked about it, because Yellowjacket specifically is joining out of the fact that he wants to be with his wife. You know what I mean? He says, I'd rather be in the lab. He mentions that than actually to be doing heroics, but I guess they need people. So they recruit Moondragon, the Wasp, and Yellowjacket. That's their team. And then they have a stadium call out where this TV announcement went through, and you think they'd get a lot of turnouts, but the only guy that shows up is the Beast. And they end up, the Stranger ends up putting these mine obstacles all over the place. And the only one that was able to get through the mines was the Beast. So they actually recruit him as a member, and that's how he joined the Avengers. But it was a pretty damn good story.
What was Iron Man's armor? Was when he had like the little peaks on the top of the yellow in the front?
No, this is the more Bob Layton type armor, the most popular one. The one with the
where it kind of had like the, well, it was like kind of circular, had the red.
Yeah.
Like, almost red, like the red come down in the middle.
It's actually the most iconic armor that I know of. That's the one that he had.
Yeah.
Hawkeye actually left to go try to recruit the Black Knight, and I don't know if that actually happens. But,
yeah, I was thinking of the, because and it's sitting right here, they came out with like a, because of Iron Man 3, they came out with some Iron Man action figures.
Yeah,
I didn't really have an Iron Man, but I grabbed the one that they called it the Classic Iron Man, and it's basically it's kind of cool because it comes with two heads. Like the one is, I think it was like a little bit earlier than the issue that you're reading, where it had the yellow, two yellow peaks, and then like triangles or spikes or whatever.
Yeah.
Not describing it really well, but then the other head is the one maybe that he has in this issue, where it's, you know, it's almost like a red Widow's Peak coming down.
Yeah, it's the Widow's Peak armor that he had here, which is my favorite. Like, he's had so much armor, you know, and this one is the one that means a lot to me, because that's the armor that I know Iron Man to have.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. It's funny because from a logical standpoint, I understand that Iron Man, like Tony Stark, you know, he builds his armor, he doesn't have any powers, so it makes sense that he would always be upgrading and changing his armor. But even though it's not logical, I just want him to always look the same. I want him to look like, wear the old armor, have it just look the same. Maybe he can upgrade the features, but it's like I don't want him to be like changing.
I almost bought that one just because I saw it at Target, and I'm trying to get away from the toys, but there's sometimes that things that catch my eye. Like I've always liked those Marvel Universe figures that are small, which is the same size as that Iron Man you just bought.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite groups is the Defenders, so yeah. I was like, I'm gonna have to seek out the rest of them, but they had a Nighthawk. And I've always loved Nighthawk. Like, he's just fascinated me. And my fascinations is his costume design. And so I picked up a Hulk and a Nighthawk, and I figure if I could get me a Valkyrie and a Hellcat and, you know, a Doctor Strange and a Silver Surfer, I'd be happy.
Yeah. That would be cool. I mean, I never was into like action figures as an adult until recently. I think I was listening to, I blame it on Star Joe's. And I've said that they're happy to take credit for that. But I did, for a little while there, I was getting a bunch so I've just been kind of like every once in a while, I'll pick up a figure of one that I like. I mostly just have DC ones, but I did start getting a couple Marvel ones. I like them as, I think of them as like my knickknacks, you know?
Yeah.
Like people have around their house as decoration. I like, you know, I put them on the shelves around the comics or up on stuff. And I find that if I have them around, cause they're characters that I recognize and like, that when I'm like hanging out around them or just like sitting or reading or something like that, I find that I, you know, it makes me happy to see them sitting there. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. There's just some, I could almost kill myself for not buying the DC ones. I only bought like Savage Hawkman, but those figures look so damn awesome. And I don't have any of the new costumes, and I was tempted. You said you had the Flash or whatever.
It's going to come. I actually pre-ordered Flash, and then because now it's weird. Mattel's doing it. They have like DC Unlimited, and they have, which that Hawkman is a part of, and then they have Batman Unlimited, and it's kind of weird how they're approaching it, but it looks like they're going to put out the more popular heroes more often. So I didn't get the Hawkman, but I pre-ordered Flash in his new 52 costume and Batgirl.
Yeah, those were the two that caught my eye that I wish I would have gotten, because they had the full set. The only ones they haven't sold is, for some reason, in that toy line, they released the Penguin.
Yeah.
And he's like Penguin classic, like old school Penguin.
He looks like the same costume as his superpowers figure.
Oh, yeah. And the part I'm really confused about is most of these figures are like New 52.
Yeah.
So I thought we'd get like a New 52 Penguin. I just thought it was an odd choice, but that's the only one that they weren't sold out of, you know? And Target's kind of weird because they don't restock right away. It's like they have this policy was, if I sell out, I'll order more, but if I don't, I'll just leave these two here hanging until clearance happens or whatever.
Yeah, and sometimes I don't even know if they put stuff out from the back. If, like they have all these, like, so I said, like, you know, Hasbro did these three figures for Iron Man 3.
Mm-hmm.
There's a classic Iron Man, there's like a modern Iron Man, and then there's an Iron Patriot. And then like right next to it, like from a recent wave of Marvel Legends figures, there's like just a peg of like four or five Iron Mans. And you know, that was just a wave of six figures or something like that. And for some reason, you know, I don't know. It's just interesting. You're right. Like, Target's kind of funny in how they stock stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is weird, the choices that they're making. The stuff that they've decided to put out.
The Hawkman just looked so damn... For one thing, Hawkman has always been visually appealing, and this has to be my least favorite, like, Hawkman costume mm-hmm. of the past.
Yeah, the since new he 52. Was.
Yeah, the new 52 one has been my least favorite. Even the Avatar stuff in the 90s I like better, where he had gloves with like Wolverine pikes on the end. But in person, that figure looks really good. You know what I mean? Sometimes you see pictures of stuff and it's just not the same. But when you physically see it, it just looks awesome. So I got it.
Yeah, some like nice detail to it and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. It's funny. It's a wave of all new 52 looking characters and plus superpowers Penguin.
Yeah.
But I guess that's what they thought would sell. Who knows? So am I up here?
Yeah, you're up.
Okay. So I read a bunch of Ultra Force from the Ultraverse. So if you don't know, Ultraverse was Malibu Comics, small, you know, comic company that was around from like 93 to 94 or so, and then they were bought by Marvel Comics, who did what what Marvel usually does, like make a half-assed attempt at integrating them into the universe and then just forgetting about all the characters.
Well, from what I understand with them, though, is they wanted to acquire their coloring process because they were like top notch. But right. Then I read an article recently in Back Issue Magazine that said that wasn't totally true. That they also wanted the properties because they were very successful in like launching, getting like animated series started up, and their books were selling pretty damn good. So it was like they thought of them as a pretty good competitor because they were selling pretty good as far as like Prime and some of their mainstays. They mm-hmm. were they were all good. I think I have everything except for their Marvel stuff, which I've been seeking out just to mm-hmm. to finish.
Nice. Yeah, there was a cartoon. I don't know if this is accurate, but it says I read something that it wasn't reviewed really well, but there was an Ultra Force Canadian cartoon series that lasted for a season or so.
It's not bad. It's not bad. And I think it's...
Oh, you have seen it?
Yeah, well, I've recently... They used to play it on USA.
Oh, okay.
But now I think it's on Netflix. And I started watching some of them. I don't know if it's still out on Netflix, but
mm-hmm.
it's there. And it is fun if you like the Ultra Force, because they have some pretty cool characters in it.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, it would be interesting just to see them translate into a cartoon, because like you said, it's a pretty... Well, I mean, right in the editor-in-chief of Malibu Comics, Chris Ulm, right in the introduction to one of the issues, he says, quote, "The Ultra Force lineup is strange, to say the least." And it's pretty accurate. Most of these... So this was the first thing I ever read of Malibu Comics or Ultraverse. This came out when I was starting high school and had just a year or so previous given up comics until college. So I knew about Malibu Comics retroactively. Well, that's not true. I did hear their name because I was around for the launch of Image Comics and bought some of that stuff right before I quit. And originally, you know, Malibu were the distributors for Image, so I saw the name Malibu Comics, but I never read anything that they published themselves. And the Ultraverse is their superhero universe, their continuity. So I pretty much just jumping in here, and these came out in the summer of '94. These Ultraverse issues, and by that point, the Ultraverse had been around for a year since the previous summer. So the thing about the Ultraverse is that, I mean, it's an appealing fact, if this is what you're into. The continuity was really strong. I mean, they were trying to, at a time when, you know, Marvel and DC were both publishing a lot of titles, and the more titles you have, the harder it is to keep everything straight editorially in a universe and make continuity strong. They were looking back, I guess, to maybe like the Bronze Age Marvel, where, you know, if you had a character, like if you go back and read like Uncanny X-Men, the Chris Claremont stuff, like, you know, if you had a character showing up in another title somewhere that he was writing, or once New Mutants was around, if you had a character show up in another book, it would reflect that in the main title, that character wouldn't show up, and there would be some reference to the fact, oh, they're over here right now, and you could go read that. And so my understanding, at least, is that the Ultraverse is like that, and you can definitely tell that reading these. There's a lot of references to other books in the Ultraverse, and most of these characters that form the initial team have their own titles, or at least have been around prior to these issues.
Yeah, Hardcase, Prototype, and mm-hmm. Prime were all their initial offerings.
Yeah, Prime
and Mantra, Prime Heart, but she's not in here.
She's not on the team. She makes a. So what I read was actually the title is introduced with two free inserts to Image or Wizard magazine, and they're numbered 0A and 0B, and they're like mini comics, like both in page count and size. Then I read the regular issues 1 and 2. The writer of these was Gerard Jones. The artist was a little unknown guy named George Perez. And the inker, these were inked by, well, 0A, 0B, and number 1 were inked by Elvay. And then number 2 is like George Perez only did the breakdowns. A guy named John Statima did the finish pencils. And then it was inked by a combination of Jeff Moiding and Barbara Kahlberg. But, the thing is like, a lot of these characters had been published for a while. You have Prime, who is kind of like a Shazam, sort of. Where he's like he's a 13-year-old boy who can transform into this. And the difference here to Shazam, Billy Batson, is like Prime is a really like hairy, super, super masculine, just like long hair, super hairy chest. Like, so it's kind of funny, like how like his masculinity is almost exaggerated.
Yeah, his costume didn't start off like that though.
Mm-hmm.
It got ugly when he got to Ultra Force.
Well, and I think that's one thing I'm kind of finding out about Malibu, like about the Ultraverse, is that there's a lot of, like, it appears to be just kind of standard 90s comic books, but when you get into it and read them, you know, a lot of these creators were veterans of the industry, experienced people of the Bronze Age, like Steve Englehart, and different, both writers and artists. So a lot of this stuff is, like, these are experienced creators who are taking the chance to subvert a lot of conventions of comic books. Like one of the titles I think that came out like the second or third month of Ultraverse being around was called Exiles. And you know, spoiler alert for a comic a couple decades old, but they intentionally wrote it as a critique of all these superhero team-up comics or superhero like teams where you have like 6 or 7 different strangers that have never met before, and within like 10 or 11 pages they're working as a team and even if they don't get along super well as like a superhero team fighting the bad guys and stuff, they get along really well, or they do a good job. And they intentionally from the beginning set it up as a team that was going to fail. They were going to show how a bunch of strangers really don't naturally work well together. And they solicited issue 5 to hide the fact that they were going to have almost the whole team get wiped out in issue 4. So from the beginning, they were going to show they were planning all these characters to die. And they want, you know, it was going to be a surprise. So it seems like that's the kind of thing that, like, the Ultraverse is doing.
Well thought out comics.
Yeah, yeah. And I got to admit, like, I didn't know what to expect. I wasn't really expecting that. I won't go into a ton of detail on these issues. You know, you got Hardcase Prototype, who is also a young guy inside of a cybernetic suit, and he's got a corporate backer. You have Ghoul, who is who got superpowers from the Theta virus, which also killed him, and so he's kind of like a zombie undead hero. You have Topaz, who doesn't really show up until she doesn't show up in the 0 issue. She shows up in issue 1. She's from a, she's kind of like a Wonder Woman if Wonder Woman was a lot more feminist, because she's from a world called Gwendor, and Gwendor, like, men are slaves. So she shows up in the middle of a, it's pretty funny, she shows up in the middle of a football game and mistakes it as combat, so starts like firing on the football players and stuff, and then she sees the cheerleaders on the side and she's like, what the hell are you women doing? You know, why don't you join me in battle? Why are you cheering on these men? And the only reason that she sticks around and joins the team is because she wants to get back to her homeworld, and she thinks that Ultra Force can help her. And she's about to actually flip out at one point when the team gets backing from the government. And it's literally like they use the real United States government at the time. So it's Bill Clinton and his administration. And one of the other members of the team picks, she's this female, like a student of kind of like a, from like a sort of like a X-Men school. She can project illusions, and she tells Topaz, she creates an image of Hillary Clinton and it's revealed to be an image, but she still like tells Topaz that even though it seems like men are like predominant in power in this world, that the real power behind the scenes is women, and like Hillary Clinton's the real power behind Bill Clinton. So I thought that was kind of like a timely, amusing little thing there. But basically, it's kind of a, you know, throughout these issues, we get the forming of the team. The threat is this King Atalon and his fire people. Contrary is this woman who's kind of like an Emma Frost, both in her costume and the fact that, like, circa Generation X era Emma Frost, where she was teaching young students. Contrary is the one that brings Pix in, and she kind of like manipulates the men, especially when she finds out that Prime and Prototype are actually teenage boys. But it backfires, you know, she kind of like seduces them a little bit. So there's a lot of like, okay, this team doesn't just gel immediately. It takes a while for the team to get together, but you do get a lot of plot and a lot of time with each of the characters. So it's not like it's just, you know, really drawn out. But yeah, I mean, like I said, I was pleasantly surprised. And the reason I read and introduced myself as Mantra was because she makes a brief appearance, which was kind of amusing that Prime. So you have Prime, who's a 13-year-old boy in this like really masculine adult body, hitting on Mantra, who's like a really sexy, gorgeous knockout woman in this skimpy costume, who is actually a man on the inside, a man in a woman's body. So you got Prime hitting on her. She knows that he's really a 13-year-old boy, but he doesn't know that she's really a man, and that's why she's like pushing away his advances. And I saw that, and I was like, what the hell?
That was one of my favorite comics, Mantra, Stranger, and Prime. Those are my favorite.
I'll just mention it really quickly since I'm already on the Ultraverse. Like Mantra, after reading these a little while ago, I picked up Mantra number one, and to show you the kind of sacrifices that I'm willing to make for this podcast, when I bought it was polybagged and I opened it.
No, it's worth a fortune.
Yeah. So, because it came polybagged with a trading card and a coupon for Ultraverse Zero. Unfortunately, it expired in October of 1993, so I guess I'm out of luck there. But I just was really curious. And again, I can't say I had... I mean, the creators, would be enough to give you a good, you know, to give you good expectations. But like, I mean, just the concept was so crazy. I really didn't know what to think. But this was written by Mike Barr, penciled by Terry Dodson, and inked again by Al Vey. And so much, and this is like a 30-page comic, and so much happens in it. It would take me a while to actually summarize the plot, so I won't. But it's almost like nowadays this would at least be two issues, if not three. There's literally like a splash page that could be the end of the issue, and then it just keeps going. And so much happens in this, but the basic gist of it is that there's these two forces, the Archimage and Boneyard, and the guy that ends up becoming Mantra is a guy named Lucas, and he's, I think since like the 15th century, they say, or something like that, he's served Archimage, and whenever him and his like other guys like him die, they move into a new body. And as I've already mentioned, eventually, and it's not the first time that it happens, the issue that he dies and moves to a new body, but the second time he dies and moves to a new body, he's always prior to this ended up in other male bodies. He being male, for certain reasons, he ends up in the body of this woman named Eden. So it's really interesting because he has to start getting used to being a woman, like, and from the perspective, and not only is he a woman, but he's a really, really attractive woman. So it's like a man on the inside experiencing what it's like to constantly be, on the one hand, he's enjoying the fact that he can use his beauty to manipulate men and get what he wants. But on the other hand, he's finding out what it's like to constantly being, getting hit on and having men like always being focused on the way he looks.
Wasn't he a womanizer at the time though too? Like,
well, it starts off really interesting because he, like, basically he jumps into existing people's bodies, so he has to deal with what their lives are like at the time. Like, one of the things that when he ends up being in Eden's body, he has to deal with the fact that, you know, she has an ex-husband and she has two kids, and he doesn't really want to have to deal with these children. Eventually has to start dealing with them. But when the comic starts, the body that he's in has a wife and a kid, and he's trying to get rid of that baggage, and he's using a private eye that ends up kind of being a part of the plot, and wondering if he's like been a leak in their organization and stuff. But yeah, like his wife and their kid show up, like, and he's basically like blowing them off and telling them, like, you know, leave me alone, I don't want to be with you anymore. And as far as they know, it's husband/father. You know, whereas he really has, it's Lucas in this body, and he has no personal emotional connection to these people, and they're just devastated. You know, he's using this private eye to kind of help him like legally break his ties. So yeah, it's kind of like, cause it's funny, like he finds himself like accidentally hitting on, or he almost hits on another woman because he forgets that he's in a woman's body. When it's pretty humorous, when he actually switches to Eden's body, he wakes up naked next to like her boyfriend, and he doesn't realize he's in a woman's body, and the guy laying next to him calls him honey, so he's like, am I gay? Did I jump into a gay person's body? And then he like looks in the mirror and sees that he's a naked chick and like freaks out and runs into the bathroom. But yeah, he's kind of having to like get used to, so I don't know if you'd like say he's a womanizer per se, but like definitely takes a lot of adjusting to being in a woman's body, and really is like trying to get transferred out of it as soon as possible and finds out that that's probably not going to happen. And, you know, ends up with these superpowers. He didn't really have, like, superpowers in his prior incarnations, but he gets this charm and of a mask and a matching actual mask, and that's, like, the source of his costume and his powers and whatnot. So, like I said, I mean, there's... I'm just kind of touching on the main figures. There's, like, there's other characters I'm not mentioning. There's a dude named Warstrike that is, like, hired by Boneyard's people. And it's just, like, and this is all in one issue. I mean, there's just so much packed in it, and I probably got it for, like, 50 cents. So I was surprisingly, like, impressed. So
what did you like better, Mantra or Ultra Force?
I think I liked Mantra better, but not necessarily the fault of Ultraverse, I mean, or Ultraforce. I mean, it's Ultraforce, like, I think I like the art better by a little bit. And I am a pretty big George Perez fan. Not that I don't like Terry Dodson, but this, I don't know if this is, I don't know when he got his start, but it looked a little, like, rougher than his stuff does nowadays. But, you know, one of the, they do, like, I could follow what was going on in Ultra Force. It's not so tied into continuity that you don't know what's going on or follow the story. That said, I could see if I had been reading these characters for a whole year and then this debuted, and, like, I probably would, there's probably references and subtleties I would have understood that could make me like it even more. So, I mean, maybe if I end up reading more Ultraverse stuff, I'll go back and check this out again. But whereas Mantra, you know, it ends up crossing into the overall universe, I know, in later issues, but starting out, it's pretty self-contained. So, I mean, I felt like I almost got like a trade paperback worth of story in this issue. So I was pretty surprisingly...
That's one thing that this podcast will do is you realize comics used to last a lot longer.
Yeah.
In other words, I read Dazzler. It took me 20 minutes. And yeah, some of these Avengers books and the Ant-Man, they're 20 minutes. And now a book is like 10.
Yeah, most of the time, yeah. So that kind of wraps up for me. I figured I'd just go ahead and talk about Mantra since I was so heavy into Ultra Force.
Yeah, I liked that series, and I guess I don't have the entire Mantra. I think I jumped off ship when Marvel started to take interest, because that's where my series start to end, around 95. Like, I was into it, and then I got out of it.
Didn't they, like, relaunch the whole line or cancel most of the titles or something? And, you know, like, they did try to do something with the characters, but they did something like, I kept coming across something called Black September, where they
matter of fact, in Ultraverse, if you look at the covers in the future, like towards 10 and 11, Black Knight was in it, you know, Marvel's Black Knight. So you could already see it starting to merge, but I really need to fill this in, man. There's so close to finishing them that I didn't realize how much I was still missing. My favorite was the Strangers, though. The little trolley car, everybody getting zapped and getting special powers and good versus evil. That was one of my favorites.
Cool.
Let's see. I got three more books. I'll go over them pretty quick. Young Justice, number 5. So I talked about it briefly in the last episode, but they're fighting this guy called Harm. And what made this really... Well, let me see. The creative team is Peter David and Todd Knock. Is what happened in issue 4 was you get introduced to this family, these parents that are like very fearful of their child. And you learn why, because their child is like a supervillain named Harm, and it's like... They're like terrified that if they do anything. Do you ever see the Twilight Zone, the movie?
No.
There was a story of a little boy who had a bunch of like parents who were like terrified of him because he could alter reality. Well, that's kind of like this Harm guy. He can't alter reality, but the parents are absolutely terrified of him. And they're actually, the Young Justice team is Secret, Wonder Girl, Artemis, Robin, Superboy, and Impulse. And they're fighting Harm during this whole episode. And towards the end is what really makes this interesting is Robin kind of throws Harm off the building but knows he's not going to get hurt because of his power base and stuff. And Harm takes over Red Tornado's body, and they eventually recover everything. And Robin's thinking it's a failure and everything. But anyway, that kid Harm goes home, and the father tells the mother, "I'm going to take care of our son," and he shoots him. Which you don't usually think. Like, Young Justice is pretty lighthearted, but
yeah,
he actually shot his son twice, killed him. I thought that was like pretty drastic to show in a Young Justice comic, but I didn't expect that. Totally. And then Dazzler, man, this comic, Dazzler is really well written. It's a good comic, even though it's so fucking bizarre. This is Tom DeFalco, who I've always liked. He's doing the story with Danny Fingerroth doing the script, and pencils by Frank Spranger. And it opens up with them like getting ready for a concert. She has three band members, and they're singing away. And one of the, what do they call those guys that carry stuff around for them? Grip? No, I don't know what they are. Roadies. Their roadie is kind of an asshole, and he's giving them shit that they suck and they they should go practice more. And their one producer for Dazzler shows up, and he's saying, "I got a gig for you." And they're like, "Wow, we're going to make some money." He says, "Yeah, somebody came down with the flu." And he says, "But you're going to have to sing country." And they're not a country band. So they have to pull that off. And Dazzler's going home in her regular outfit, and she runs into like a subway, and there's this gang, and they're gonna steal from this couple. And then she actually uses her light based powers and takes out one of the gang members, and the gang members, "You're letting a woman do that to you?" So they're going after her. And then she's able to use sound to blast those guys and knock them unconscious. And one of the assholes she was trying to protect says, she's a mutant, you know, and tries to get everybody to chase her. And then she shows up at the concert, and Bruce Banner shows up, and she's playing at a university, and Bruce Banner's trying to get a job as a janitor, but doesn't have a social security number, so they won't hire him. So he gets a job being another roadie, helping him carry stuff into the concert, because he's looking for a lab to do something so he could try to not become the Hulk again. And he's taking lots of like tranquilizers. The one thing that was funny is he almost became the Hulk because he got stressed out by the person that was going to give him the janitor job, because she says, "Can you show me your social security number?" And he goes, "Oh no, my heart is racing. My pulse is racing. What am I going to do?" Because she asked for his social security number.
I like that era when Bruce Banner was kind of just like homeless, kind of wandering around.
Yeah, it was a fun era. So she actually comes out on her skates in her same disco outfit and puts a cowboy hat on.
Damn.
starts singing away. And Bruce Banner actually becomes the Hulk because he tries to raid the lab, and a bunch of cops start chasing him, and he becomes the Hulk and trashes the stage, and Dazzler tries to take him out a little bit, and that doesn't work. And the Hulk eventually just runs away, knocking down the area. So the concert started off real successful, turned into a disaster, and then there's some sinister guy that's just watching. But I'm highly entertaining, man, and then really dense. Like, there's a lot of story in here. I mean, I've seen Dazzler fight Dr. Doom already, and now she's fighting the Hulk.
Yeah.
It's just weird. It's such a weird comic. And it's so weird too, because her dad is kind of like the parent that I would be. Like, her dad was always trying to, why don't you go and be a lawyer? Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? And, you know, because there's money involved. And she's like, no, I want to. So she's like broke. She like lives on ramen noodles. And, you know, like she's trying to start her career. She's not popular now. A lot of times she works just for free. But she wants to sing. And her father's like, you got to have an occupation and sing on the side. You know what I mean? Have your money so you can do what you want to do. But Dazzler wants to go on about her own path and become successful that way. But Dazzler comics are fun. I mean, they're fun. And then the last book I want to talk about is Wonder Woman 223. And this one is... I'm still filling in gaps in my Wonder Woman title, and I'm enjoying it. This is by Martin Pasco and Jose Delbo, who's with Vince Coletta and Julie Shorts. So this is a weird comic because it apparently takes place like right after her white costume, you know, the one that she had back in the day where she lost her powers and was changing, training under that one blind martial artist.
Yeah, I Ching, I think.
I Ching. And these comics from this era, this is 30-cent comic, they always seem to show what's happening in the action and then go back and show you how they got there. So there's men paratrooping on Amazon Island, and if they touch the ground, all hell's going to break loose because man can't set foot on Paradise Island. And then you flash back to her in the Justice League, and it's like they're questioning her and they want her to be back in the Justice League, but she doesn't remember anything about like that era where she wore the white costume or lost her powers. And she can't figure it out. So she says, I need to get away for a while. She goes back to Paradise Island, and that's when these men start paratrooping down. And a lot of the Amazons, as soon as they're hitting the ground, they're aging because they became immortal. Aphrodite made them immortal Amazons, and now they're not immortal because man has touched the ground. So she's trying to get them to stop, and then she realizes that these men are made of clay, except somebody has to be real because they're aging. So she's trying to figure that out, and then her mother starts telling the story of how, you know, the Amazons can't have men on the ground, and then she tells a story about how Hercules and her got it on and that kind of thing, and Hercules betrayed her. And then she apparently loses her mom, and she's still around, and she's fighting these guys. And then we get an interesting service announcement from Superman. It's called Justice for All, Children 2, Part 2. And it shows two guys spray painting a wall, two kids, and the cop is saying, hey, what's going on here? And he's chasing the kids. The kids run away. And then the guy of the store comes out, and he's saying, officer, I hired these guys to paint murals on it, and they ran away like they're criminals. And Superman gives him a speech saying, you know, by running away, you made yourself look guilty. You should have stuck around and respected the policeman. So that's your public service announcement.
Don't run from the police.
Yeah. And then, so Wonder Woman, at this time, Steve Trevor's dead, and there's this chair that can restore memories. Well, for some reason, her mom knew about it and restored all her memories except when she had lost her powers, because she didn't want her to think that she was weakened at any time for some reason. Mm-hmm. Well, now she starts to remember everything. Steve Trevor's apparently dead. I guess he died in that arc, and I just don't remember. And, the one man that touched the ground is Aphrodite brought Steve Trevor back to life. So that's what's interesting about that, is now Steve Trevor's, it's like retconned. Steve Trevor's back to life because Aphrodite brought him back to life. So it was a pretty cool comic. I'm enjoying these Wonder Woman comics. I know a lot of people don't dig Wonder Woman, but I think she's pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I didn't really, like I said, I mean, not only did I not read DC as a kid, I didn't have much interest in Wonder Woman, but different creators have brought me in to where I have more of an interest in the character. And I did pick up the first 8 or 10 issues of George Perez's Wonder Woman. I haven't read them yet. I got to read them at some point.
Yeah, those are amazing.
Yeah. But what issue of Dazzler did you say?
Number 6.
It was 6. And what was the number of Marvel Feature?
Marvel Feature was number 8.
Oh, okay. Yeah, one thing I wanted to give a shout-out, I think I may have mentioned this briefly before, but talking about Malibu Comics, the podcast called We Talk Comics, and last year I listened to an episode that they did that's it was sponsored by Comicosity, comicosity.com, and it's, I mentioned his name earlier, it's with the former editor-in-chief of Malibu Comics, Chris Ulm, and co-founder publisher Dave Ulbrich. And it's a really, like, they basically go through the entire history of Malibu from it starting out in the 80s, setting up the Ultraverse and the buyout by Marvel Comics. And they ask some really good questions and find out some new information. So I just want to shout that out. WeTalkComics.podomatic.com. You can find it there. I basically listened to it as kind of like an education for myself in Malibu Comics. And, you know, now that I've actually read some Ultraverse stuff, I'll definitely at some point listen to it again. But the connection there was also Paul O'Connor, whose site we've mentioned on the show at longboxgraveyard.com, was also involved in making this happen because he did some writing for Malibu, and I believe it was, and he currently works with Chris Ulm at a place called Appy Entertainment that I believe they make like apps for like iPhones and stuff like that. So so if you're interested in Ultraverse and haven't heard that, check it out.
Yeah, I want to revisit that, and I want to revisit CrossGen.
yeah, that's another one that crossed my mind because of the whole acquired by Marvel and like gathering dust kind of thing. Because I read a bunch of CrossGen.
Well, I was really fond of Malibu, any of the companies from Malibu or Ultraverse. I liked a lot, like Dinosaurs for Hire. I loved that book and the Protectors and stuff, which had the first bullet hole cover that I know of.
Nice,
but I was really fascinated with that company. I really enjoyed Valiant being my favorite of all time.
Yeah.
And also CrossGen, and they were all very similar to me in the fact that their continuity and their universes were very tight, but there was a relationship amongst all books.
Yeah.
And you kind of felt it. But I think that's why I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Yeah, that's one thing that the podcast has done to me is looking for different things to talk about and finding myself interested in the, you know, independent comics. I mean, I read a lot of independent stuff nowadays. I read a lot of Image and stuff like that, but that was an interest that developed when I got back into comics in college. You know, I grew up reading Marvel and a little bit of like DC every once in a while. And the only reason I got interested in Image was because it was formed by all the artists that I liked. And then I got out of comics. So like 80s stuff that I was too young for, or like stuff that just came out and like when I wasn't collecting comics. So it's been really interesting finding all these 80s and 90s comics published by independent companies that, you know, are really good and really cheap for the most part. You know, it's just amazing how much stuff is out there, especially from like the 90s. I mean, a lot of stuff, even people that were collecting at the time, I think there was such a glut of stuff being published that you know, you just couldn't, like most people missed stuff, you know.
But that's an era that people condemn, and there's a lot of gems in there.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, you saw the stuff that was real big and popular and sold really well, and, you know, like, you get distracted by the gimmicks and stuff, but, I mean, yeah, there were crappy comics that used cover gimmicks and polybags and stuff, and then, I mean, there were also comics that, even though they used some of those sales gimmicks, I mean, like Malibu, like I said, I opened the polybag of Mantra, and, you know, they did a lot of cover things and alternate covers and stuff, like, and I'm guilty of this too, like, you judge a book by its cover, and I didn't expect a whole lot, but in the case of some Malibu stuff, I mean, there were some cool ideas in there. I mean, like I said, they, at a time when a lot of the big names, when you had Image Comics, a lot of the big names were young guys in that had just broken into the industry, and in some cases even pushed aside creators that were like had been around for quite a while. It seems like a lot of them ended up doing work for companies like Malibu, and talking about creators that had a lot of experience, and so they went on to like experiment with ideas at places like Malibu. So it's pretty cool.
All right, we have a few questions, right?
Yes.
Luke Foster asked, what was our first non-Marvel or DC comic book that we tried out?
Yes, I had to think about this one for a little while.
I know what mine is. Mine is Judge Dredd from Eagle Comics. That was the first one that caught my eye on the shelf. And I continued to get like everything from Eagle Comics once I read it, because I was kind of blown away. Like, this is so different that I didn't know this stuff existed. But yeah, I was so Judge Dredd, and I started reading like all of their stuff, like Robo Hunter, and I can't even remember all their titles. Nemesis, I think, was another title at the time, and Rogue Trooper was another one, and I can't remember all of them, but. Yeah, there was at least 5 or 6 books that I started buying because I like Judge Dredd so much.
And that was something you just saw on the stand and caught your eye?
This was like at the dawn of when I discovered comic book stores, because this isn't something that you would find on the spinner rack at the drugstore. Yeah. And when I discovered the comic book store, yeah, I would still get my Marvel and DC, but there was stuff on the shelf I didn't even know what existed. And I was very picky with my money, because I knew I had I had to mow so many lawns and do whatever I needed to do to get the comics that I was going to get.
Yeah.
And very picky, because there were characters I was real passionate about, you know, and I had to get those comics. So I didn't explore too much, but I did explore with Judge Dredd, and I fell in love with it.
Was Eagle Comics, was, because Judge Dredd's always been a British property,
yeah, I think, right? It was an American company that was reprinting stuff, but that's like when you started having the Brian Bolan covers and stuff like that.
Cool. Yeah, I never heard of them. I've heard of Judge Dredd, obviously, but.
And then they eventually became, well, let's see, it was Eagle, Fleetway, and Quality. They kind of morphed into a bunch of companies, but it was really the same. But those are the, if you're looking for comics, those are the companies: Eagle, Fleetway, and Quality.
Nice. So I think it's kind of hilarious, but I think my first comic that was non-Marvel or DC was Youngblood number one.
There you go.
Because, like I said, I mean, I, you know, I was a Marvel guy, and I pretty much only read Marvel comics. I saw some Spider-Man issues with Todd McFarlane art. I thought that was amazing. You know, Liefeld took over New Mutants and turned it to X-Force. I thought his art was amazing because I was, you know, 12 or 13, and that's like his target audience. you know, like I liked Jim Lee was, I think, Jim Lee probably was my favorite, or maybe McFarlane. It's kind of like a toss-up between the two. I mean, I still have an appreciation for Lee, though I wouldn't, like, I'm not super, super crazy about Jim Lee's art. Like, I won't buy something because he did the art. I won't not buy something, whereas opposed to, like, if Rob Liefeld is the artist on something, I don't care if it's my favorite character. I mean, I know it's fashionable to bash him, but I'll be honest, I just really don't like his work, and I don't like the way that he acts in the comic industry, so I won't even buy something that, like, he'll make money off of. It's just personally the way I feel, but one artist I'll say that I have that was a favorite of mine when I was a kid that I still do really appreciate is Eric Larson.
He's my favorite of the Image creators. He wasn't my favorite at the time. Like,
me neither.
In other words, when Image exploded, I think it was McFarlane, like Spawn. Like, that's what caught my eye, and I was a Liefeld guy, and who was the other guy that I liked? I kind of liked Jim Lee, but for some reason, he wasn't my top. Like, Wildcats was never my top, but it was Youngblood and Spawn. But over the course of time, like, because I went from McFarlane to Larson and Amazing Spider-Man.
Right.
And it was kind of a drastic change. But mm-hmm. Larson grew on me in Spider-Man. And then when he went to Savage Dragon after about his first three issues, mm-hmm. and then he relaunched or whatever, that's when I became, like, hooked. Like, this is the Savage Dragon is my comic. And yeah. Savage Dragon is the one that I'm only missing like 10 issues, and I've read everything that I have of his. Yeah. And that's the one that I'm fond of. And now that and over time my liking of art has changed too. Like,
yeah, definitely for me too.
So like Eric Larson to me has a style. While it's his own style, there's something there that reminds me of Kirby. And I don't know if it's his panel layouts or just the way he creates his worlds or what, but it reminds me of his kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's almost like if you combine like Kirby art with like 90s art or something.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that like in a derogatory way, like I still, yeah, for me, like, my tastes have changed a lot, and Eric Larson, of the ones that, like, formed Image, that's the one that, like, has held up the best for me, but, like you, he wasn't my favorite at the time. I liked him a lot. I mean, I had a subscription to Amazing Spider-Man while he was the artist, so I have, like, I have a lot of nostalgia for his run, and I picked up, you know, Savage Dragon when it was first coming out. Yeah, Youngblood was what launched Image. And I was all about Image because, like, you basically took all the artists that I liked, and I was mostly about the art back then. I almost pretty much stopped buying Marvel Comics and bought Image stuff. But then, like I said, the timing of it was also that it was like the year before I started high school or something, and I completely quit comics in high school. So I think that was the first one, though. At first, I thought it was Turok the Dinosaur Hunter, or whatever it was called, from Valiant, because that was one of the few Valiant books that I had that I remember, but that actually came out after Youngblood.
Yeah.
So...
And then you waited forever for number two and number three and number four, and you're like, what the hell's happening? Image went out horribly. to yeah. like off to a horrible start.
It was a huge problem.
With shipping. The only one that was consistent, Savage Dragon, and I think that's why it grew on me, is I would always be able to get that book.
Yeah, I think he was, I mean, he's a pretty smart guy, and I think there was the 3-issue miniseries, and then I think he took a little break and then launched the ongoing,
the new number one. Have you ever met Eric at a con?
I haven't really met hardly anybody.
So fun to watch him draw, because he holds a pencil like nobody I've ever seen before.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's like clenches it like in a fist. It's weird. It's very unusual. It's like, how do you even draw like that?
Yeah, the only comic conventions I've gone to are like local shows where it's mostly dealers, where I've just like dug through, you know, quarter bins and stuff like that. So if I do, I'm hoping to go to Baltimore Con this year. So if I do, it'll be like a new kind of experience for me.
I hope so. That's what I'm going to.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of my motivations is to meet people and stuff. So
we had one other question. I don't remember what that one was. That was
It's kind of similar. It's what's the oldest non-Marvel DC comic we've ever read? Like oldest in like publishing date.
I have to look this one up because I know what it is. I just...
Well, while you're doing that, it was pretty easy for me because I... last year, I knew that I had read some old Golden Age stuff online. Like stuff that's now in the public domain. Because I was kind of curious about like superheroes that really just kind of golden age superheroes that never really got, you know, nothing was ever really done with them. And I read issue 1 of Blue Bolt Comics. And this was a character created by Joe Simon, and then he brought in Jack Kirby to help him, starting with like issue 2. And it was basically like a lot of golden age comics. It was anthology style, so it was called Blue Bolt Comics, but there was the Blue Bolt story, but then there was other stuff in it. But, this came out in 1940, and it was published by Novelty Press, and it's basically about a football star that's struck by lightning, underground scientist finds him and heals him using some like experimental treatments that give him superpowers. So, you know, guns would disappear because of the comic code, but like a lot of superheroes at the time, he had like a gun that fired lightning and he had his superpowers, and he ends up fighting, I guess, in this issue, his main nemesis is this woman called the Green Sorceress. But apparently later on, like a lot of superheroes at the time, he ended up fighting Nazis. But so yeah, that's the oldest thing. Might be the oldest comic I've ever read. Well, no, I think I think Batman's like late 30s, right? Or
Was it the oldest that you ever read, or the oldest that you've owned and never read?
It's the oldest I've ever read. Like I said, it's in the public domain, so it was a site that had it reproduced.
Yeah,
I didn't
interpret it like that because I think I've read earlier stuff.
Oh, okay.
I just
I might have.
It's easier for me to go into the database and look at what I have. And the way I inventory stuff is probably bass-ackwards because I inventory them based on when I've read, you know, when I read them, and then I inventory them, which is horrible because then you don't necessarily know everything you have, right? You should inventory it when you get it. But, which I'm starting to do. But there is a slew of books that I didn't do that with. So I'm just going to tell you the oldest one that I own that I've read. And it's from Fox Comics, 1946, March of 1946. And it's Blue Beetle number 41. So that is the oldest one that I have that's inventoried. I could have some older stuff now. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to like when, like I've read all the old Golden Age, you know, like Action Comics, and but I don't own them. I might own them in hardcover or something, but I'm not really good with dates, so I'd have to go look at like when Action Number One came out, or that's a hard question without thinking about it. And unfortunately, I lost the question because Twitter only can hold so much. And
yeah, the only reason I was able to find the question so easily was because I had responded to him and said thanks or something, so I was able to go on like to the like mentions. But yeah, that's the way I interpret it. But if it was something that I owned that was non Marvel or DC, it's probably just something from the early 80s. I mean, it could even be John Sable, because my collection doesn't go back that far. I mean, I think my oldest comics that I own are probably, I have a little bit of, the bulk of my collection is like 80s DC and maybe some 90s stuff, and then I have some 70s. I started to buy some 70s Flash. So it's probably like my oldest comic is probably like an issue of 70s Flash or something.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I've just recently acquired a lot of the Captain Marvel, you know, the 10 centers, which might even surpass this one, but I don't have them in my inventory yet. And then I got those Joe Simon, Jack Kirby Fighting Americans, but I haven't read them yet.
I think the oldest comic I've ever read is probably Detective Comics, 27. Might be the oldest thing I've ever read. Because I have the Batman, couple volumes of the Batman Chronicles.
Yeah.
The cheaper color reprints that they've started to come out with.
Yeah, I guess so. Those Fighting Americans were 54, so I have more stuff from the 50s than I do the 40s, so yeah, I bet you that Blue Beetle is the oldest thing I have that I've read.
Yeah, it's pretty old.
Yeah, it's huge. It almost looks like Borderline magazine. Like, its comics were big back then.
Yeah, Golden Age size.
We had two other questions. Let me see if I could find them on Facebook. One of them is a sarcastic one, but let's see. Daryl says, "Who is Jack Kirby?" He doesn't have a love for Jack Kirby like we do. But he doesn't like fun either.
No. Yeah, I got it too. I gave into one of his, like every once in a while, I think he baits people.
Yeah.
You know, he'll put out like a tweet just to set people off. So every once in a while he'll trash Batman, the Brave and the Bold.
Oh no, he hates that.
Yeah. And
that's legit.
Yeah. No, I know he hates it. I'm just saying like,
that cartoon was awesome.
I know. It's so good.
It's his loss.
So we went back and forth for a little while. And then the next time he did it, I just ignored it.
Yeah.
Or I said, "You're hopeless," or something.
William Purcell says, "Will you ever review America versus the Justice Society?"
That's funny.
My answer to that, well, for me, it will probably not. Because what I'm doing the retrocast for is trying to get caught up on things that I have that I haven't read, and I have read that series, but I don't know if you will.
My answer to that is yes, I will. I don't know if I will for next time, but I will read it and talk about it, because I have it, and I can't remember if I finished reading. I know I started reading it at one point because I was going to kind of like read that, and then there was like a 8-issue Justice Society series, and then a 10-issue Society series, and then a little bit after that is when they launched JSA, and I kind of want to read JSA from the beginning again. I just kind of like want to read my way through a bunch of Justice Society stuff and like All Star Squadron. Like I love that stuff. So yeah. You know, maybe in the next few episodes, I'll try to read that and talk about it.
Yeah, I will revisit stuff if I have it on heart, like a recollection or something.
Yeah.
But if I have to dig out my long boxes, that's gonna be tough.
No, and I mean there's so much stuff out there to read. You know, it's to reread stuff. It's got to be something you really.
I really liked it.
I started to say that.
My focus is focusing on stuff that I haven't read, unless it's Jack Kirby, of course.
Yeah, and also, I mean, like you can tell, I've been reading a lot of like, you know, the first couple issues and stuff just to introduce different titles and stuff to the podcast. So we sort of built up a broad spectrum of stuff we've talked about, you know. It brings up new conversations and stuff. So
we got one more question. This is from Vicious Smith or Ken. He says, "Best Jack Kirby design or top three if you wimp out." Well, for me, that's easy. If you just go top one, it's Mr. Miracle. I think his costume is the best. Followed by, if I have to do top three, Big Barda. Honestly, I love her costume. Even though, like, Oberon loves it when she's out of costume.
Yeah.
And I guess my third one is Omak. So that was pretty easy for me.
Oh, man. Damn. As more of, like, a Kirby apprentice than an expert, I think, off the top of my head, not knowing this question beforehand, I think one I'll say is going to be Galactus. Just sort of an insane concept and sort of a precursor to some of the other, like, you know, galactic or cosmic beings. I'm going to go with Desaad as like a character, I guess. Maybe not like the visual. I don't know. Is it more, do you take it more as like the visual design or just as like a character concept or?
Says design, so.
Yeah.
He's still a cool design, especially the way he draws those little strands of hair coming down off of his forehead.
Yeah, and it's like a character concept. Like, I just find him so like creepy and frightening. I think that's one of like the most. Like, Darkseid is, like, imposing and frightening in, like, a powerful way, whereas, like, Desaad is, like, a scary, kind of creepy, like, horror movie kind of character.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll say the Black Racer, just because it's such an insane concept. No, I'll say Metron, because I like the whole chair and floating around space, and he just like, yeah, has like a really cool look.
He's done so many damn good creations. I would like to narrow it down by like year, because he creates so much a year that
I'd have to spend a lot of time with that question to really.
But all time for me,
accurate.
I mean, Omak is my like one of my favorites, but costume wise, like the design, Mr. Miracle and the discs and stuff. I just find in the colors. I don't know why. Yellow, red, and green appeal to me, but I guess they do.
Nice. Yeah, that's a tough one. A lot to choose from.
So maybe we could save the other question for next time. We were going to do a topic on sitcoms, but since we're, what are we already at?
Let me see. Almost 2 hours. Yeah, we can do that. Because I think we could get some good mileage. I did... kind of quickly come up with a top five. And then I also had like a bunch of honorable mentions, and then also just shows. I found out, like, looking that, you know, when I was growing up, I pretty much, like, from, like, maybe around, like, 84, 85 till right before high school, like, 93 or so for me. As a family, we watched a lot of sitcoms, I'm remembering, so I got a lot I could mention, so we could probably get a good time off of that. Might as well save it and give it the proper treatment.
Yeah, instead of rush through it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're going to jump into Jack Kirby's Fourth World Army Bus Volume 2 and start off with Mr. Miracle number 4, which has a pretty damn awesome cover because he's in that death trap that Dr. Bedlam put in that one, what was it, like a building of like so many stories.
Mm-hmm.
And this was like, we'll talk about this specific scene later on, obviously, but it has Mr. Miracle getting put into an Iron Maiden.
Yeah.
By some, like, guys from the Inquisition.
yeah, it looks like, when you look at the cover, it looks like he's been transported back to, you know, back in time. And it even says a medieval death trap. And, yeah, I had to, I didn't forget what had happened, but I realized it's been a little while since we read the previous Mr. Miracle issue, because, you know, we recorded 3 weeks ago. Did we have one that time, or was it? So I think it's been a while since the last time we read.
Yeah, it's been at least 3 weeks.
If not
we probably released the episode 2 weeks ago, but
right.
This issue, like, man, I just love what this whole idea of a death trap that Bedlam put in there and the paranoia pill or whatever the hell it is. And this continues where that left off. And this is the first appearance, I believe. If not, she might have been in a post-up or something, like a pin-up or something before. But
right.
A big Barda, this is like her first showing. And she meets up with Oberon, and Oberon's not too excited to see her. He thinks of her as like this mean, evil, crazy, muscular woman.
Yeah, and not without reason.
Yeah, because she does smack the table that he was sitting on, like.
Yeah, kind of just kind of daydreaming. She comes up behind and smacks the table, and then like grabs him by the shirt.
Yeah, wake up, you Zero.
So she comes in pretty intensely, and I've been like, Big Bard is a pretty iconic character from the Fourth World, so I've been waiting for her to show up, and it's not until we get into Volume 2 here that we finally see her. But we don't have to wait long in the issue. She's on the very first page.
Yeah.
But yeah, the setup, we last saw Mr. Miracle, it's kind of unclear as to how he was going to survive this one, because he's basically tied up inside of a box that's roped shut, and then inside the box he's roped up, and it's plummeting basically, you know, all the way down the middle of this building. So Big Barda has, oh, and like the mobs, like you said, the Dr. Bedlam had given all the people in this building paranoid pills, so they all are seeing different, you know, they see Mr. Miracle, they look at Mr. Miracle, but they see like a demon or like one of their worst fears or something, so they're all trying to kill him on top of it. And they're the ones that put him in this trap. So Big Barda finds out from Oberon what's going on, so she sometimes, like most people we've been seeing travel between places on the boom tube, but she uses her mega rod to transport herself to where, and she knows Scott Free, Mr. Miracle, somehow.
And she is the big honcho of, she actually works for Darkseid, like she's Granny Goodness's general.
Yeah.
So well, that's how she has the armor.
That's how we end up finding out that you know, that they knew each other when Scott used to be in Granny Goodness's orphanage. He knew Big Barda from there, and that they're, we find out later that she helped him escape.
Right.
But she stuck around, and they still have a connection, and she goes to save him. She actually gets there in time to catch the case that he's supposed to be in, and she rips it apart with her mega strength, and no Mr. Miracle. And it turns out he actually escaped somehow. As the thing was flying down, he somehow got out and is standing on one of the balconies above, like partially untied from his bounds. But he's still got the mobs to deal with. There's still the people who look at him and think that he's evil and are still trying to kill him.
He's a vampire. They're trying to drive a stake through his heart.
Yeah, they think he's a vampire and try to stake him.
They even try to hose him down. It's like, yeah. One of those like fire hoses.
With like a fire hose. So yeah, he actually ends up on a movie set. There's like a movie being filmed in the building, and these the cast and the crew are no exception to the paranoia. So they're still filming the movie, but they bring Mr. Miracle in, and you know, and this is how he gets put into the Iron Maiden. Because they have the Iron Maiden. I guess they're not messing around, because it's not a facsimile of an Iron Maiden that they're using to film this movie. They're using a real one. And so they shove him in there, and they close the door, so it's not clear how he's going to survive that one.
And they think Big Bart is a witch. And
yeah.
She doesn't hold back as much as like Mr. Miracle. Like, these are innocent people. She just kicks ass.
Yeah.
Knocks people to shit.
She grabs like an entire like load bearing column. So like this huge, looks like it's made out of marble or something. She rips it out and then just tosses it at like 7 or 8 dudes. That we don't see the aftermath, but I can't imagine that they like caught and held on to it.
Yeah, when she's got like these 8 dudes that she hits with the mega rod, that's an awesome panel.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mr. Miracle, I think, is trying to say, well, don't help me out or you break the deal that Bedlam has with me, you know? Like, she can't interfere.
Right, he's supposed to escape on his own. Yeah. Because I think what's the threat is that he's going to kill everybody in the building if he doesn't escape on his own or something.
Right.
But, you know, she goes to rescue him from the Iron Maiden and again finds that he's already escaped. And we don't know how at this point, but they have kind of they're reunited and both of them look pretty different. And she only recognizes him because of his voice, because she's never seen the Mr. Miracle costume before, and he's never seen her dressed up in the armor that she has. So they both have changed a lot and look pretty different than when they were in the orphanage together.
And I did find this really jarring, the next 2 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was like, you're going along this adventure, they're escaping the building, and then you're all of a sudden they boom themselves in with their mega rod into Oberon's house. And they're there. And then they like flash back to tell how they got out or how he got out of all the traps.
Yeah, it was a pretty abrupt change.
That was the only thing I didn't like about the issue. Kind of like you had him describing how he got out of stuff, and rather than seeing it while it was happening, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I wanted to see how they got out of the building and stuff, or how the people ended up.
Yeah, I agree with that criticism. It's, you know, but I'm glad we do have the space to see the three of them interact, and Oberon, not too impressed with it. Big Barda, at least in her apocalypse armor. Big Barda, likewise, calls Oberon a little rat and says that he ought to be disciplined, but... later on, Scott and Oberon are making dinner, and Oberon calls her Attila the Hun.
But then she comes out in her skivvies.
Yeah, but she shows. So we get like a little, like a few pages of, we actually find out how, like, Scott reveals to Oberon how he escaped from all those traps during the issues. But yeah, then Big Barda shows up just like basically in underwear, like new God's underwear.
And I like his comment. He says, "Whoever made that gal wear a uniform should be horsewhipped."
She walks in. Scott's not looking, and he says, "Oh, Barda's all right. She's just a child, you know, a powerful, deadly child playing soldier." Meanwhile, like, she's walking in behind him, talking about the dinner smells good, and I love Oberon's, like, all dressed up for dinner. He's got, like, a all-green outfit on. Like,
it's like a leprechaun.
Yeah, it looks like yeah, that's true. But it's, like, the look on his face is, like, total shock.
Yeah, and that on that second panel, it's awesome.
Yeah, he's like,
oh my God, that's the sexiest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Like, because she's like, it's like a woman that's like three times his size.
Yeah.
So, and Scott finally sees her. He says, "I take it all back. That's a big, beautiful woman playing soldier. She's no child anymore." So, she finally got Oberon to come around by taking off all her clothes.
Who wouldn't she get to, you know, do that?
Yeah. So, that wraps up Mr. Miracle, number 5.
That was my favorite, but I really like Forever People, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. They're pretty close.
These two storylines, you know, with his deadly trap and then the Forever People in the amusement park, I've really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've been pretty strong. Forever People, we did talk about last time, I think, and that ended with the introduction of a character that that we start this issue with. That's Sonny Sumo. He's on the cover too, holding the mother box above his head with a whole bunch of villains around him. Well, in front of him, but then he's got like the Forever People are in the background behind him.
And one thing I found really interesting is like Sonny Sumo was like a Fight Club dude. Like, that's what he was. Yeah. He would do is he'd go fight in front of people and always win. And they eventually devise a robot looking, awesome looking robot to fight Sonny Sumo. And I guess this is like before they show it to the live public. They're like demoing him, and this robot can fight like nobody's business. Like, it almost like fights to the death.
Yeah, Sagutai, yeah. The robot's name is. He basically, I mean, we have like an interlude in the middle of here, but he basically, it looks like Sagutai is pretty much going to kill Sonny Sumo. He like blasts him with a flame throwing. He's got his fingers can shoot flames out, and he burns them all up. And then some of the like gangster looking dudes that are watching, like, start to protest. Like, this is getting to the point where it's going too far. It's like the robot's gonna kill him, and he does this thing called wound rejection, where he concentrates and all of a sudden, like, like all the burns and all the damage that he's taken so far all disappear, and he gets like a power upgrade and just like picks up the robot and smashes it.
But what I found interesting about that, like whatever that trance that he goes into where he concentrates and he like heals himself, he's really not healing himself, but he's like healing his appearance, it seems like.
Yeah, it's like we find out it's kind of like a temporary fix. Like he powers up and is able to like finish off the battle, but he retreats pretty quickly. He's got to, like, he can't stick around. He runs right to the locker room, and pretty quickly afterward, all the wounds come back. And he's not expecting it, but, you know, prior to this all going on, he had found a mother box, and it's the mother box that ends up healing him and for good, for real, and communicates with him.
Yeah, he says he needs his help. The mother box, mm-hmm. So that's where he's going to help the Forever people. Prior to that, though, we have some interesting Desaad, like scenes where you experience how exhilarated he gets when he sees people suffering.
Totally,
like it's so a total, it's a total joy, and he just like he can't understand why Darkseid doesn't like it's like
I love that.
This is the best thing ever, you know, torturing people. Why doesn't Darkseid? You know, why doesn't he get the joy that I do out of torturing people?
What can equal this for joy? I find it strange that Darkseid would shun this.
Yeah.
It just does not get why Darkseid's focus is not on torturing people. It's pretty great.
So Sonny Sumo ends up getting ported into that like horror tunnel that they were in where Moon Rider's in. And he's trapped in that glass as a skeleton, and the first thing he does is shatter the glass, and he frees him. And then he's off to free Big Bear. You know, they're at the shoot the robot bear thing.
Yeah.
And he frees Big Bear by destroying the whole, you know, device that they were shooting at him in. And they rescue Big Bear. He looks pretty messed up.
Yeah, he... Yeah. Yeah, Big Bear is in pretty bad shape, and only because he's got the mother box can Sumo see through all the illusions that the regular people are confused by.
Desaad realizes that they're under attack, and he sends his guards, who are pretty damn loyal to him, as well as Darkseid, and the next person they go to try to rescue is Beautiful Dreamer.
Yeah.
And they kind of do that by saying, everybody step away, you know, this exhibit is closed.
Yeah, the one guy is not too happy.
Yeah.
Totally what would happen if...
I want my money back. Exactly. I'm going to complain to management.
Yeah, totally. You'd definitely have somebody around saying that.
And
I pay good money for this.
Then Seraphim is rescuing Viken on that contraption where he has to like save him from the roller coaster ride. They actually get him out of that mother box. It looks like gets him out of that. It gets Viken off of there.
Yeah. Cause Seraphim. So Viken is in a chair underneath a roller coaster, and his head pops up into the path of the roller coaster, and Seraphim has to hit the button to push him back down so his head's not cut off. And I find it interesting that, you know, Viken is the one that, when the Forever people are all together, he's the one that's, like, most in charge of their mother box, and he discovers that he can hear the mother box communicating with him, even though he doesn't have his usual helmet on. So he seems to be, like, kind of surprised to find that out, that he's, like, it's like he's been so close contact with their mother box for so long that he's developed ability to hear her even without the helmet that he used to use.
So all of their guards are chasing Viken, and they all end up in the same room, and Sonny Sumo actually touches the mother box, and he's like, lower your weapons, sleep. And we discover that Sonny Sumo's got the anti-life equation in him, and you're like, holy shit!
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, from the beginning of the Fourth World Saga, like, Dark. We know Darkseid's been looking for a mind that can understand the anti-life, and for Sonny Sumo, it's just like something that comes to him naturally. I mean, he like the, those panels that you're talking about. I mean, he holds the mother box and just kind of does it like naturally. And the panel where he says sleep, you know, you got a lot of like Kirby energy. It's very sketchy. It's kind of like this huge energy blast, and then you turn the page and it's just like Sumo and the Forever People are just standing there, and all the Dark Desaad's men are just laying on the ground asleep.
And that's where they reveal that he has the anti-life equation, and Sonny Sumo like doesn't even know what that is, but you know that Darkseid and is after that, so he's gonna go try to capture Sonny Sumo.
Yep, and they and the Forever People tell him, you're going to be objective number one now, because they know Desaad has basically the whole complex wired, so they just assume that, and assume correctly that, you know, Darkseid is watching, and will be now after Sonny Sumo, so... And they, the Forever People basically explain that, you know, their whole deal is they want freedom. So they're against anybody that's going to try to control them and, like, make them act against their will. And Sonny Sumo's pretty much down with that, so he's willing to join up with them and oppose Darkseid. And that's kind of where things end for now.
And this might have been like a bonus issue because you had a full comic, and then we get Tales of the Young Gods of Supertown, and they introduce Lonar.
Yeah, this was pretty cool, I thought.
Yeah, it was very Commandy-ish, I thought.
Yeah, actually, I was thinking it reminded me of Commandy, too, because, you know, it's like post-apocalyptic.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it really interesting, like, you know, before Kirby went to... DC, he had been doing Thor and touching upon the whole Ragnarok myth of like the which is like, you know, like the destruction of Mount Olympus and the gods, and Lonar is basically he's traveling and like searching through what Kirby calls place of the elder gods, and it's really kind of like implied, I thought, that the elder gods are like, you know, the gods of
had their Ragnarok,
Thor and stuff like that, and he picks up like a helmet that looks sort of like similar to like a Thor type helmet, and like old weapons that you would associate with Norse gods. So it's really like he's like searching through the wreckage of a Ragnarok, and it's pretty cool. But he ends up discovering a battle horse that he rides. But and I liked how in the last panel also that you, I guess he's on New Genesis, and it's like wreckage of. From the Elder Gods that still exists on New Genesis, because you see in the background of the back panel the like floating city that we've seen before.
Yeah. So that one I enjoyed. You know, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Extra, and we get like a splash page of Kalibak the Cruel.
Which I guess this is his first appearance.
Actually, we haven't seen him in a while, but I think... Did he show up? Jimmy Olsen, but yeah, he was like early on, and like right towards the beginning, he was in. I can't remember if it was Jimmy Olsen.
Oh, was it the Mantis one? Didn't he show up?
No, I think it was even earlier than that.
Oh, okay.
It was like right at the beginning, like if not in the first three issues, like the second three issues that we did. But that was it. Like we haven't seen him for a while. And I love it. He's actually like holding a hand mirror. And like admiring how ugly he is. This is a face to fear. Someday, Kalibak, you may supplant Darkseid himself. So he's like talking himself up. It's like his prep talk.
He does kind of look like Orion when he goes into ugly mode, except he's huge.
True. Yeah. Yeah. That's
and true. Orion doesn't look like he has, like, two toes. They must have different mothers.
Yeah, I guess so.
So we get to Orion. New Gods number 5, and this is only 25 cents bigger and better, and I think that's what the Forever People was, and that's why we had the bonus feature of Lonar.
Yeah, must be.
And this is Orion versus Slig, who's a Deep Six villain.
Yep.
And this one has some really cool... There's that photorealism crap happening when Mentron's floating on his chair, and he runs into... like a elder god or somebody that was trying to break through the fourth wall. And he's trying to, you know, see why this giant is actually chained to like this huge, it looks like an asteroid of some type, but it looks more mechanical because it's got like things, you know, around him.
Yeah, this is really fascinating to me.
That's an awesome splash page.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Like, Metron is minuscule compared to this huge, huge meteor. And, it's like he comes across a couple different, it's like basically, you know, the High Father has his staff and that's connection to the source. And they have the source wall where messages come through. But Metron, as like a traveler and like an explorer, he's
trying to find the meaning of life, it seems.
Basically, like. Yeah. I mean,
the Big Bang, you know, what created everything?
The actual source.
Yeah.
And it's pretty kind of frightening because like this giant and another like almost kind of like fire looking creature, they're basically just floating and Metron thinks like, these beings were as extremely as intelligent as I am, and they're just trapped here now in what he calls eternal humiliation. So he's kind of like checking things out, kind of taking a look, but he's sort of scared away by the fate that others have faced before him by trying to enter, like, kind of, like, basically the beginnings of the universe. But I did find it funny, I think, last time Steve made a joke about Spawn and Todd McFarlane, because we, at the end of New Gods 4, we got the name of this issue, which is called Spawn.
Yeah.
But it actually does, like, on the way that the font that the word Spawn is written, and it actually kind of also looks like the Spawn font. It's like red background with, like, kind of scratchy, rough-looking letters. That's a pretty real interesting intro.
And then it cuts to the scene with Lincoln, who's one of the Orion followers, if you will. Mm-hmm. And he's at the police office, and Turpin is questioning him, because Turpin knows that Orion is, you know, a god or something. Something's going on, and he's questioning, trying to find out information. And Lincoln is very, you know, he's withholding all that information. He doesn't want to tell him. But Turpin's on to something. He knows something's going on.
And Lincoln gives him a lot of credit in his thoughts. He's not going to help him get there, but he thinks to himself, it's not going to be long before he figures it all out.
And then they're back at the apartment, and this is kind of like when they're trying to disassemble the team, I guess. They don't know where Orion is, and the insurance guy says, hey, I gotta go back to my family and work and all that. And the one young guy says, you know, I gotta go, my parents are probably anxiously awaiting me to show up again, because he's been gone for a while. And Claudia says she'll stay around for Orion, she's got the hots for him.
Yeah.
And Lincoln also stays around,
because basically, I mean, like, they've been together and helping out Orion since he brought him back from Apocalypse, so that's kind of cool to, you know, to recognize, okay, these people had lives, like, they need to get back to, but they're, you know, they're willing to help out if they're needed. Even Victor Lanza, the old guy that really stepped up last issue, and pretended to be a gangster and stuff, and found the machine and found the passageway that Orion took to the Deep Six, and that's where we go next. Yeah, I thought it was pretty funny that so we find Orion is like trapped by a giant clam. His foot is stuck in the clam's mouth, and it's a giant because Slig can he can basically take stuff and like mutate it and make it grow big with his one hand. So he picks up this crustacean creature and holds it, and it just like grows into this like long pink nasty looking creature. So definitely some like weird crap going on here. You got like a giant clam, and then you got a giant pink creature. So Freud would enjoy this scene, I think.
But his hands are pretty cool. He's got one hand that could you know do that. It's like create life, right. I guess, or make it bigger. And then he's got on the other hand the one that can bring death or disintegration.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty cool. For some reason, that's kind of a weird. But for some reason, it made me think of Buona Beast.
Very curious to see if Slig ever occurred again, and I just don't remember him.
Yeah, because he's not as big of a name some of these characters is.
Very cool design, though. I like mm-hmm. his design.
Yeah.
The weather over here sucks, and Harley can't make up her mind if she wants to go outside or not.
Oh.
Go on, Harley. Go pee-pee. Go pee-pee. She's like, she's very indoor type dog.
Luna loves the snow.
Yes, I got pictures of her playing in the snow, but she doesn't last too long.
Yeah.
And it's coming down some more today. It was really bad on Thursday, man. I work late on Wednesday, like really late, and I came home and I had four-wheel drive, but, man, there was cars, like, stuck everywhere, and I don't work very far, and there's no hills where I work, so it's like the car, it was like driving on sheets of ice, and then there was so many snow, like, we got, like, 6 inches in 3 hours, and
wow.
Cars were just bottoming out, you know what I mean? They couldn't steer because it was so dense.
Dang.
But they canceled Barb's works, and that's the first time they've done that since I've been here, since she's worked there.
Yeah, that's got to be pretty bad, then.
Yeah. But back to Slig.
Yeah, so he's a pretty crazy creature, like a crazy dude. And then So Orion ends up, like, fighting... kind of like wasn't really sure what's going on here. He's on the floor of the cave, and he uses like he's got like circuits in his wrist or something like that. I guess he's always like looking for his equipment, right?
Yeah.
His because he doesn't have his helmet or
it's his mother box ping. It's pinging in his wrist, and he uses that to destroy the clam, essentially.
Yeah,
get his way out of there.
And he runs into another creature called Shark Seed. And this is definitely Seed, not Side, because it's S-E-E-D.
Shark Seed. And he beats the hell out of him.
Yeah, he's basically a shark man. Like, he's got, like, a man body and, like, a shark head, and he's purple. So.
And then, interesting enough, he runs into this weird-looking log, like it's huge, almost like one of those things that Mentron ran into.
Yeah.
Was stuck in this contraption that was floating in the ocean or whatever it is. And he knows that there's a big-ass creature that's being released and wants to go track it down.
Yeah, he basically, like it's... He recognizes that it's a harness of some sort that used to have a creature trapped in it, and whatever it is escaped, and whatever it is like humongous.
Yeah.
Just based on the harness.
And then Turpin's awesome because he like goes to the hospital for one of the cops he works with, and he gives him a cigarette, lights him up at the hospital. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And he gets more facts about what's going on with all the beings that are showing up on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's trying to get to the bottom of it, and he tells. Yeah, I like that. It's like throughout this, we've had a lot of the, you know, even though this is like was being published in the 70s, we have like a lot of guys dressing like it's the 50s.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like that that's acknowledged here. It's like Turpin's comes out of the hospital room and he's talking to a couple uniformed police and so, you know, he tells them, you know, don't put down anything about UFOs. And like Turpin's like, you don't see anybody wearing derby hats, but I do. And the uniform cops like acknowledge that it's like that it's old school to be wearing a derby hat.
It dates you, Sarge.
Yeah, you're still hanging on to the old times when you took the Tommy guns away from the gangs. And Turpin basically comes down to what he says is like, that may be the case, but it's really like this war is not really that much different between gang wars. It's just gang war on a larger scale. So it's kind of how he's looking at it and how he's able to process it all. It's like just looking at it like another gang war just between gods, basically. And, Lincoln and Claudia, like you said, are the ones that stick around the apartment and are waiting to be contacted by Orion, or, you know, figure out where he went or what's going on. And they think that maybe he's coming back. They see a boom tube open up outside the apartment building, but fresh off of admiring himself in his hand mirror, Halibak shows up.
He's a very handsome man.
Yes, according to him. He says, crawl, you earthworms. Kalibak is here. Brown.
And then you have the face-off between Orion and Slig. And this one, Orion kind of goes into his berserker mode. Like, where he actually starts, his face is literally changed into more like a apocalyptian than to be somebody from New Genesis.
Yeah, you can kind of see it coming because he's really getting into it. Like, you see that he has the battle lust.
Yeah.
That people from New Genesis normally doesn't, and he's sort of losing himself in the sort of like a berserker kind of thing, and he's just like he's practically like making fun of Slig and laughing at him because like his mother box, like Slig kind of has like a corrupted version of a mother box, like as a part of his equipment or his costume or whatever. And Orion actually rips that off of him and
kills it.
And basically kills it. Because he separated it, like the mother box disappears. He can't. I mean, he and we see a panel of Slig, and Slig is not looking good. I mean, Orion really beat the shit out of him.
Yeah, the one thing that was weird too is he like killed that mother box, and then he's like laughing, and he's like, she loved you, Slig. Like, he's getting enjoyment out of what he just did.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, Superman or something where he fights because he has to, but if there's another way, you know, to accomplish his goals, he won't. Like, Orion isn't getting into it.
And Slig notices that Orion has a unibrow now.
Yeah. Yeah, basically. He's like, ah, you're evil. You have evil in you. I know it, because you have a unibrow. But yeah, it's Slig's turn to laugh, because he sees what Orion really looks like, and laughs at the fact that he's a monster himself. And Orion finally kind of like gets himself together and uses the mother box to, you know, put back his face that he prefers to show people, the face that Claudia is in love with. And but that doesn't stop him from throwing Slig down like a bottomless pit, basically tossing him to his death. Or he's certainly not careful about whether he's going to survive or not.
Yeah, you definitely see the dark side to Orion in this issue.
Yeah, for sure. Which, we've gotten a lot of foreshadowing of that, so it's cool to see that progress a bit. And, you know, Orion gets his equipment back, and that allows him to escape and, you know, come out of the undersea water area that he's in. But we end the issue with, we finally get a glimpse of the thing that was trapped in that harness. It's like this huge, pink, crazy Kirby sea creature with, like, tons of horns. It's like if you crossed a whale with, like, you know, it's like a whale from Apocalypse, practically. It's like a armor, he calls it a, like an armored mountain given angry life, eager to revive the dreaded myths which have terrified seamen since ages lost.
Yeah, it does look like a whale, apocalyptic whale, but it's confusing how that bottom part of it. It's like he's got this thing coming out of his bottom that...
Yeah, it's like a weird...
Looks like a snake head or something.
Yeah. It's almost like he's got like a built-in battering ram under his mouth.
Yeah.
Pretty wild looking.
And then we get another Tales of the Young Gods of Supertown, and this time we learn about Fastback, who's kind of like their version of the Flash. He can run very fast, very light ray.
That's
light
true.
Is, but he's kind of like, I think, more grounded than Light Ray. Light Ray is like flying all over the place, where he's got his aerial boots, and it looks more like he's just moving at fast paces than.
Yeah. Yeah, there's like some kind of a game going on. Like, he's got arrow pads that he uses, and there's spectators, and you know, I love the designs of these like crazy kids. Like, you know, there's a bunch of people that come in on like on machines and gliders that are kind of like Orion's Astroglider, and they're wearing these like bizarre costumes that are like kind of like futuristic versions of, like, that's almost like how Seraphim incorporates like Wild West. Like, one of the character has
like a buccaneer,
like shoulder pads and like a buccaneer hat, and the other one has like a hood and a visor. And it's just, like, he's very good at, like, sometimes you get, like, you go back and you look at like science fiction from like the 50s or the 60s, and like, it doesn't look futuristic anymore. Like, his designs were so off, like, so imaginative that, like, you can look at this today decades later and it still looks futuristic, because it's not, you know, it's just so different. So yeah, it's pretty neat. This was a little more humorous than the other backup, which it ends really weirdly. Like, I wasn't seeing this coming at all. Like, he's all of a sudden, he's just teleported without warning, and these people change his outfit, and he has to go sing for the High Father.
That was bizarre.
Yeah, it was really weird. Like, I guess he's got a beautiful, he's got a wonderfully beautiful voice, and whenever the High Father wants him to show up, he just teleports him without warning to sing for him.
Yeah,
and then he, like. But he's not a, the High Father is not going to, let him off easy. He says he did a good job, but I do detect a few neglected passages. You should spend some time brushing up on them. That's the end of the little story. His High Father telling him he still has work to do. It's just really strange.
Yeah, it was bizarre.
Yeah. But I like, it's cool to see, you just hear about Supertown, you know, and it's cool to see, like, these are these characters are definitely within the line of the Forever People, so it's kind of cool to see, you know, where they come from and other, you know, futuristic teens like them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, and that that wraps up the Kirby for this time. It looks like next time we're going to get a Jimmy Olsen, number 142, and
143.
So we're getting two of those in a row, and then another Mr. Miracle, number 5. So, oh yeah, so I guess this time I think I called it 5 earlier. This is issue 4 that we talked about today. But, so I don't know. I mean, we'll see what we get here. It's fresh off of what's his face? Don. Why am I drawing a blank?
Don Rickles.
Yeah, Don Rickles. Fresh off of Don Rickles, we got a vampire on the cover of Jimmy Olsen number 1. So who knows? You never know what you're gonna get.
You never know.
That's one good thing. So
now I want to go read some John Sable.
Do it.
Yeah. All right. Well, this has been Geek Brunch episode 8. Geek Brunch Retrocast episode 8.
Yes.
And you can reach Chris on Twitter at MythMakingETC and me at Mike Myers Brunch. And we have a Facebook page. You could search for Geek Brunch Podcast. That's where Geek Brunch and Geek Brunch Retrocast are hosted.
Yep.
We have a forum for geeks. And if you scroll down to Geek Brunch, there will be a thread there for this episode. And there's also a thread there if you have any questions or comments. Those ones you can also send through Twitter or you could send through Facebook. I'll try to get it like I did this time. Like, we got some last minute questions that came like 10 minutes before the show, which was kind of cool.
Yeah.
What else do we got?
Email. You can email me at mythmakingetc@gmail.com. And Mike is mike@comicbooknoise.com.
Yep.
And
leave an iTunes review.
That might be it. Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
Go to Geek Brunch and search for Geek Brunch in your little browser on the iTunes store. And then once Geek Brunch comes up, click on that and you can leave a review. And you can even post like what you thought. Verbiage, you could leave verbiage or you could just say how many stars you give the episodes and stuff.
Yeah, which that, you know, whenever you get reviews and ratings, that, you know, makes it easier for people to find the show if they're not looking for it specifically and they're just like maybe looking for comic podcasts or, you know, the more ratings and reviews, the better chance that people are going to come across the show.
Yep.
That way, so that's always, if you want to help out some way, that's really helpful. And I think, you know, I think we still haven't, we're still waiting for the first issue to, or first review to mention the Retrocast specifically, so you can, there's reviews on the Geek Brunch iTunes page, but there's none specifically mentioned Retrocast, so if you want to be the first person, you know, we'll mention you on the show.
Yep.
We'll come up with
that. We will read the comment and mention it on the show.
And we'll both think you're really awesome. So, I think that wraps things up, though.
Yep. All right. Well, you have a good week at work, and I will talk to you again in 2 weeks.
Sounds good. It was good talking to you.
Yeah.
Take care. Be careful with all the snow.
Yeah, are you getting snow over there?
We're getting a little bit today, but it's been funny. Even in this area, because, you know, we're near the two Great Lakes, you know, different areas will get snow and we'll get more than others. And usually, like, we're in the area where it gets a lot of snow. And so far this year, it's been more up north of us, like closer to the lakes and like in like town of Niagara, like, or like Niagara County, Niagara Falls kind of area and stuff. So we've had a couple big snowfalls, but not as much as some years.
Yeah. Well, Well, we don't really get... This is the first time that we had it bad, like, just so much in such a short amount of time.
Yeah.
And now we got the win today, so we'll see what that does, but...
Yeah.
Harley's getting... she wants to go more for longer walks, but it's hard to when you're walking on ice.
Yeah.
I take her on the sidewalk where they clear it, and then... Mm-hmm. But I can't take her for her long walk, which is, you know, about a mile. You can't do that. And I think it's starting to get her, you know. Like yesterday, she just went and ran around and played with the chihuahuas next door. And she just barks at them.
Yeah, Luna starts. We try to walk her as much as possible every once in a while. If it's, you know, if she hasn't gotten a good walk, she gets restless. I mean, you got to be careful. We had a storm that went from rain to snow, so there was ice underneath the snow on the sidewalks, and I almost wiped out. It was a close call, but I almost wiped out walking there the other day because you can't really see it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's dangerous if you don't see it. Like me and Barb bit it one time when Risa and Scooter were still around, and you get hurt pretty bad if you fall on your back.
Yeah, if you fall
tailbone,
without
tailbone, yeah, it's like you have nothing and nothing's bracing you, and yeah.
Yeah, I think like a decade ago, I fell twice in the same winter on ice outside, once on one knee and once on the other, and my right knee especially has never been totally the same. I never really had it, like I didn't have any health insurance at the time and never really had it looked at, and it used to cramp up on me all the time at night. Now it just kind of like randomly gets sore if like I'm sitting for a while, or if it's gonna, like, I wouldn't be surprised if when I'm old I have like arthritis in my knee or something because of it. But yeah, I mean, when you fall like that, you don't, when it's fast and you don't have a warning, you don't have enough time to like brace yourself, you can really get you pretty bad.
Yeah, it's, so. Yeah, I don't want to, I hate not taking her, but she even slips too, so.
Yeah. You
know, even though they have four legs and they're closer to the ground.
Yeah.
She starts running around and.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. All right. Well, have a good week, man.
All right. You too.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, Jackie, how are you?
Gee, you smell like a brand new haircut.
Gee, you're pretty, Miss Crabtree. You're prettier than Miss McGillicuddy.
Jackie!
Miss Crabtree, there's something I want to ask you.
Go ahead, Jackie.
Jackie, answer the door, please.
Oh, for the love of Pete.
I'll be right back.
Hi, Babby. Well, what do you want?
Then we'll just keep passing by till you come to the river and then drop in.
Oh, Miss Crabtree. Brought you some flowers.
Oh, aren't they pretty?
I brought you some candy too.
Why, Norman.
Hey, how did you get in here? Oh, I just flew in.
Jackie, will you please excuse us?
You, but the snake? Hey, Pansy, well, what do you want?
As you go out, pull the curtains, will you? This is private.
Read it.
Oh, Norman.
Don't call me Norman. Call me Chubsy Upsy.